Welcome to the Wampa's Lair podcast. Deep in the bowels of the frozen ice caverns of Hoth, our hosts, Carl LeClaire and Jason Hunt, have been frozen upside down to the cave ceiling with nothing to do but talk all things Star Wars. So make yourselves comfortable, but keep a wary eye out for trouble here in the Wampa's Lair.
Hello, Mr. Jar Jar Binks, Mr. Your humble servant, and this is the Wampa's Lair podcast, episode 10, Jar Jar Strikes Back. In this episode, you, the hosts, are going to be talking about Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. They're going to review the newfangled 3D, and there's a general analysis of the film. So please, without further ado, here's Sir Carl LeClaire and Jason Hunt. Oh, Misa got to go warm up Misa toes now.
Oh, I guess he's walking in Boston or something, because it's cold here tonight.
Yeah, you know, Gungans don't exactly do well on Hoth here in the Wampa's Lair.
No.
So.
No, and I'm sure that they would be a tasty treat for a Wampa, too. So that's got to got him a little bit nervous.
Probably. A little more jittery than normal.
Oh, some. It's an exciting episode. It's an exciting time for Star Wars fans with Star Wars back in the theaters, and it's our 10th episode. I mean, it's like it's just a big night for us in the Wampa's Lair. So I'm excited to be back at it again.
Oh, as am I. I'm really excited about this. The Phantom Menace, just seeing it again in the theaters, you know, not necessarily even in 3D, but just having it back in the theaters is just so exciting for me. I had a blast going and seeing it Friday night, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah. Yeah, we have quite a bit to cover tonight, which is exciting. We've got the 3D to talk about. We've got, our lightsaber matchup. We have our first giveaway to talk about at the end of the show. I mean, it's going to be – got a lot to talk about, but it's all good stuff, so I'm excited. You know, rather than dilly-dallying, might as well get right into our first issue, as always, is our lightsaber matchup. And this past couple of weeks here, we've been asking people to give us their input, and – The duel is between Grandmaster Luke Skywalker, so Luke all the way up through the Fate of the Jedi series, versus Darth Sidious. And again, this is Emperor Palpatine throughout all the expanded universe as well. We got quite a few responses again, which is great. So I'm going to let Jason go ahead and get after those.
All righty. Well, over on Facebook, got a response from I believe a new poster, Pete Searing. If we're talking about modern-day Fate of the Jedi Luke, then he has to beat the Emperor every time. He seems to know more about the Force than anyone and has defeated all the big dark side names around, beaten the Emperor twice, and is younger than the Emperor. Brian V. Klein responds again, "Oh man, this is a tough one. On one hand, you have Sidious, arguably the most powerful Sith ever, or at least the most powerful Baneite Sith. But on the other hand, you have Grandmaster Luke, who is unmatched in Jedi skill. What I think would happen is that it would be an even fight for a while, since Luke is holding back his powers because he's not letting his anger and hate power his actions. When Sidious starts to get the upper hand, akin to the end of the throne room scene in Return of the Jedi, when Luke is getting pummeled with Sith lightning, I think Luke finally unleashes on Sidious to save himself from death, him off. But since he is older and more in control of his powers and has skirted and been over to the dark side, he doesn't succumb to the dark side and actually gains power by further learning how to use the other side of the Force for good. So I believe Luke would win if and only if he could harness his dark side to keep from being defeated." We also got a response from Jazz, our friend from Norway. "I agree with Brian on this one. Luke has matured so much since Return of the Jedi, where he is the Grand Master of the Jedi Order. Sidious would probably resort to Force lightning, but since Luke has been on the receiving end before, he wouldn't be surprised and would be prepared for the attack. In addition, he would have learned Other Darkseid tricks from his days of flirting with the Darkseid, from Sidious himself, or at least his clone. Although the Emperor probably has quite a few tricks he didn't share with Luke, I believe Luke's calm, mastery of the Force, and skills with the lightsaber would give him the strength he needs to put Palpatine down for good. So it's 3-0, Luke over Palpatine, and we've got two more responses. On Twitter, we got a response from Nancy Pants. She says, we're talking Grandmaster Luke circa Legacy of the Force and Fate of the Jedi? No question, then. Luke all the way. And then we got an email from somebody calling himself Master Joss, a new listener. He says, hello, Jason and Carl. My response to this duel is that Grandmaster Luke would be victorious. For one, his mastery of the Force is far beyond what he ever had in the films. In time, he also has become a master of his emotions. Unlike others responding to the duel, I don't think Luke would have to draw on any dark side of power. His amount of power in the light side of the Force is described in many of the books as more than a match, even against Sidious. Also, he's a skilled duelist and has practiced against powerful opponents now. Mentally, Luke would be in control and stay in control during the engagement and won't fall prey to deception or any tricks the Dark Lord can throw at him. These are the reasons why Grandmaster Luke would be victorious. With that, my friends, may the Force be with you always. Master Joss. So, our fan responses have it unanimous. A 5-0 Luke over Palpatine. This actually surprised me a little bit. But before I give my thoughts on the duel, I'm going to turn it back over to Carl, since I have been talking a lot.
Yeah, I again, just a quick little thank you to our listeners for writing in. The more you type in, the more fun we can have with this. And that being said, I'm going to have to get in the grounds of what our listeners have been saying. I also think that Grandmaster Luke would be victorious. I wasn't too surprised to see the listener's response is giving him Luke a unanimous victory. The only person I was looking forward to hearing from, because we've heard from him before, we didn't hear from was Lord Bruticus, you know, the brutal one. I thought he would certainly chime in for Sidious, but that's okay. Maybe he's been busy. But I think the reason Luke would win, again, just, you know, I don't have much original to say from what our listeners haven't already said, but again, he's become so powerful in the Force into the expanded universe that I think he's far beyond anything Sidious was ever capable of. And I think the dark side drains something from you, whereas the light side gives life. I feel that the dark side, which draws purely on raw passion and selfishness, ultimately drains a user. So I feel like the longer Sidious is around, the more actually weak he becomes, at least physically speaking. And I think Luke, by becoming such a strong person in the light side, he's going to be even stronger than Sidious could ever dream of. And not to mention the fact that Luke, again, you know, flirted with the dark side in the Dark Empire series, so he kind of knows the tricks of the trade. He's been around the block. He knows what's coming at him. And, you know, with a blade, I think Luke is unmatched. I mean, Sidious fought Yoda to basically a standstill, but I think Luke has probably surpassed Yoda's ability. You know, based on some of the stuff I read and some of the expanded universe I've read, you know, it seems like Luke has become, you know, like he's a freak of nature with his lightsaber, not to mention his Force adeptness. So I think, hands down, Luke takes this one. But what do you think, Jason?
Well, Palpatine may be my favorite Sith, but I'm going to have to make it a unanimous 7-0 against Palpatine. Luke once asked Master Yoda, is the dark side stronger? Yoda says no, but it is easier and more seductive. I think Luke has finally gotten...
How does he say that, though, Jason?
I'm just
curious.
No, but easier and more seductive.
Sorry.
No problem. Any opportunity I get to do a voice is much fun. But I think at this point, Luke has gotten past the point where the dark side is easier and more seductive, and he just naturally is stronger in the light than anything else and anybody else previous. He's probably progressed so far and so much and has the light side so ingrained in him that at this point the light side is easier and second nature to him to draw on and to use. So I do think even if, you know, even a force duel, lightsaber duel, duel of wills, Palpatine may be a master puppeteer, he may be a master planner, but Luke is just stronger with the lightsaber, with the force, and with will power than Palpatine ever was at this point. So I'm going to have to make it unanimous. Luke Skywalker, victorious yet again. Good triumphs over evil. Huzzah.
That's how it's meant, you know, meant to be. That's like life, you know?
Exactly.
We're good, yeah. So is this our first unanimous victory completely? I'm not sure.
No, we had Jason Solo trounced Savage Opress a couple episodes ago. So,
we've yet to see any Sith users trounce anybody, though. So that'll be interesting for later.
Yes, that's true. Very true. We've got a couple of duels planned out ahead of time, but you're just going to have to wait and find out what those are. We're not going to give you any hints.
None at all. Except for the fact that they are Star Wars characters.
Yes, that is true. But you're going to have to stay tuned until the end of this episode to find out our latest duel, and it's a good one. So I'm curious to see what people think about this. So.
I am too. So, but shall we begin with our talk of episode one, The Phantom Menace in three dimensions? 3D.
Yes.
Sorry, not as exciting as I wanted it to sound.
Talk of Star Wars, episode one in three dimensions.
Way better. Yeah. Thank you. This is why I need you all the time.
I just need to be like your announcer and narrator. Makes things just a little more epic.
Oh, exactly. Oh, today's Valentine's Day, so Jason, happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day, Carl.
That's so cute. All the women are saying that's cute.
Of course. If we have women listeners. I think we have a few.
Yeah.
I think we have a few.
Yes, my girlfriend listens to it occasionally when I can convince her. So, I think she secretly loves it. She's just afraid to admit it. But enough of that. Let's get back to The Phantom Menace in 3D.
Yes. Enough of this lovey-doveyness. This past weekend, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, reopened in 3D, and it was awesome. I was able to see it Friday night, and I believe that was when you were able to see it too, Carl. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I wasn't able to go to the midnight show because I work at 6 in the morning, so wasn't going to happen.
I had an 8 o'clock, work the next morning, so I was like, I could go, but then I would probably not do very well at work. And then a bunch of friends were saying, oh, well, we're going to go Friday night. So I was like, I'll just go with you guys. So so that was nice. It was a lot of fun. I went and brought my lightsaber, my Force Effects build-your-own lightsaber to the theater. I was the only one at that showing that had a lightsaber, but everybody in there thought it was awesome. So I was very pleased with myself.
Yeah, I like that you brought that. And it's a build-your-own, so it's your lightsaber.
Exactly. Although I had it sort of modeled after old Obi-Wan's lightsaber.
From episode one?
At least
one?
This time. From episode four.
Oh, okay.
So, but because I didn't have pieces. Otherwise, I would have done it to look like Obi-Wan's in episode one, but I didn't have. It doesn't come with pieces to make it look like that.
Gotcha.
Unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But anyway, enough about my lightsaber. 3D! Three dimensions! What did you think of the 3D effect of The Phantom Menace?
I thought it looked really good. There was no new changes or anything. I mean, same version as the Blu-ray. And honestly, I don't know what the difference were between the Blu-rays and the DVDs anyway when it comes to the prequel trilogy. So I'm not the best to quote on that. But it was, you know,
I think the only difference between the Phantom Menace between the DVD and the Blu-ray was digital Yoda. Only difference.
Yeah, and I again would say that it looked so much better than that puppet that they had had.
Yes,
it looks great, and 3D. I mean, it looked great. I mean, the picture quality was awesome. You know, the thing that caught me, I don't know what caught you specifically, but what I was most looking forward to in 3D didn't necessarily look exceptionally awesome. Not to say that it looked bad, but the things that actually seemed to jump out of the screen most at me was basically the characters themselves and more of the slower scenes. Like, that's what I found. The thing that jumped out at me the most of all was Watto. When Watto was, like, fluttering by and stuff, it's like he was right in my face, and I just thought that was really cool. But some of the bigger, like, you know, the flight into Coruscant or, you know, fleeing Naboo or whatever, those were kind of the things I was looking forward to the most. And, you know, they still looked cool, but they didn't necessarily jump out at you. But again, I mean, remember, they're converting a film that was not shot in, you know, for 3D and 3D or anything. So that conversion isn't going to be, you know, perfect like these new films coming out shot specifically for 3D. But, I mean, it still looked great, I thought. Yeah, so I don't know. What about you? What specifically jumped out at you, Jason?
What I really liked was just how the depth of everything. The one thing I did notice and did appreciate was that nothing came like out of the screen at you. I think that was something George Lucas said he doesn't really like much of. It was almost like the screen was your eyes, and so everything that you were. Everything was on the screen was something that you were seeing, and it was like deep enough from your point of view, and so that was really nice. And I think there was one shot in particular in the space battle at the end of the movie that just like took my breath away, and I involuntarily just when it happened I went wow. Just sort of involuntarily, because it looked amazing in 3D. And that was the shot where there's like three Naboo starfighters that just start like diving down towards the battleship with all the laser fire and explosions around them. That one shot was just amazing. And as far as Watto was concerned, he looked amazing in 3D. And I think the 3D really helped the computer animated characters like Watto and Jar Jar and the battle droids, because it gave them a depth. Instead of just having them stuck up there on the screen with sort of a feigned depth that you would get on a regular TV. But the 3D helped give them more of a solid foundation, and I think actually helped a lot of the computer animated characters and environments that some of the complaints in the past have been about. So I think 3D is a better way to see computer animated things.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I agree, you know, I mean, there's nothing that like jumps out in your face, which to me, it's almost corny. I mean, what I think they did a good job of with the Phantom Menace is they harnessed this 3D ability to just, again, like you said, give it a tremendous amount of depth to the film. It does make you feel like you're more involved in the picture. I mean, like literally it captures you in without making it like corny and over the top. I think some of the drawback of a lot of, you know, modern 3D movies is, you know, they sacrifice the story, they sacrifice, you know, a good film for just simply, you know, the bells and the whistles, if you will. Whereas this is still like, it's still telling you a story, but it's giving it to you in a new way. It's still the same story, but with a new way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And I appreciate
There was one other cool shot that I really enjoyed. And it was basically just like a camera pan over Coruscant. I believe it was when they're going back to the landing pad before they leave back to Naboo. And it's like that introductory like location panning shot where the landing pad is, you know, down farther in the screen, and the camera just sort of flies overhead around the side of the landing pad. And it was really cool because the way that the 3D worked is it looked like that was you flying around. And at first it sort of caught me off guard, and I was like almost like, oh my gosh, I'm looking down into Coruscant. That's really far down. But then I was like, oh cool, it's almost like I'm flying. But I think it's, which is something I've always liked doing. I went skydiving twice, and so the feeling like I'm flying is just something I love. But maybe that's why I noticed it. But I don't know, that just like those, almost like the helicopter shots that they would have in there with like the camera panning around, actually felt like you were up there, you know, looking around at things. So I thought that was really cool.
That is really cool. Yeah, I might have to. Maybe I'll have to go see it again this weekend and take that in a little bit better. Will you see it again? Do you plan on seeing it again?
If I have money. My sister hasn't seen it, and my parents and my brother saw it back in San Antonio over the weekend, too. They saw it on Saturday. So if my sister and I can find a time, I may take her back to go see it.
Sure.
But there was one thing that I noticed in a couple shots that didn't quite work as far as the 3D is concerned. And it was only a few shots. And the shot I'm thinking of primarily is early in the film. I believe it's when Palpatine is talking via hologram to Queen Amidala, and the hologram goes out, and, you know, Sayo Bibble has that, you know, line that's full of doom and gloom, you know, loss of communication can mean only one thing, invasion, you know, yes, invasion. And it's one of the shots of Queen Amidala, of Padme, and in the background you see the Naboo Royal Guards, and they're out of focus because of the way that it was shot originally. But even with the 3D, they still were out of focus. And there were a few shots in the movie where I noticed that happening. Not very many, but there were a few shots, and so that was the only thing that I noticed about the 3D that was just a little off. But in general, very good 3D movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, I did not notice that. But yeah, speaking of that scene, actually, speaking of Sayo Bibble, he's like my favorite character in The Phantom Menace. Just kidding. I do like him though. And how he looks the same in episode 2, even though it's like 10 years later. I actually liked the scene though when they, when it's the shot of basically the Trade Federation coming into Theed as all the, you know, all the tanks are rolling down the main street there, and the staps are flying by through the sky, and then it's, you know, Padme looking out the window in defeat. And I loved that shot. I don't know why in 3D, it really did hop out at me. And, I thought it was it was just very well done. It was never a scene that stuck out to me before, but after seeing it this time, it was actually one of my favorites. So,
that was cool. Especially that view from the window overlooking the plaza as the tanks are going by, and then the staff just flies by your face real quick. That was actually really cool to see in 3D. So, I do agree. Any other comments on 3D or the experience over the weekend?
Yeah, the only other thing I did want to comment on, just very briefly, is the experience again. I knew going into it, this isn't something I haven't seen a million times before. I mean, every Star Wars film I've seen dozens of times. I can recite them as I watch them. But again, what was so great, I mean, it's been now, what, 2004? So it's been 8 years since a Star Wars film, or excuse me, 2005. So 7 years since there's been a Star Wars film in theaters, which was obviously episode 3. And it was just so cool being back at the theater again to see Star Wars. And there wasn't a huge turnout. I literally bought my ticket 20 minutes before the showing and didn't have a problem. I mean, there was a crowd, but it certainly wasn't close to sold out. And there was only one person in costume. There was a guy sitting behind me in his Jedi costume, which was very – he had a really cool costume. But my favorite part, again, was as the 20th Century Fox thing came up, just the amount of applause, and then the silence at the A Long Time Ago screen, and then as that crescendo, and I thought the opening scroll looked awesome in 3D, and just
yeah,
the roar of the crowd during that scene, I was like, yep, this is Star Wars. And it's like, settle in, because here you are watching it how it's meant to be seen. And I just love that feeling. And I'm so ecstatic that the rest of them are going to be coming out. And I think we'll see a very different attendance once the OT comes out as well, because I think that those are just the far more loved films. But, you know, it was just great being back in the theater for Star Wars. And just, you know, and the scene when Darth Maul shows up in the hangar right before the duel, like, everybody starts cheering. Like, it was just so cool. Like, I got goosebumps again. And I'm just like, this is great. So, yeah, I really liked that.
Yeah. The turnout wasn't huge at my my showing either. And there wasn't exactly a lot of, like, applause or you know, yelling or anything at the beginning of the movie, but as the end credits started to roll, everyone in the theater clapped and applauded. I think when Darth Maul showed up, there was a few, like, yeah! Not very many. I know I basically, like, jumped in my seat because it was just like, yes, you know. But the group I was with was probably the most animated group in the theater, so that was a lot of fun. I heard over the weekend it took in, like, I think 23 million for opening weekend, which is pretty good for for a film that's everybody's already seen, has access to on DVD, that's just getting released in 3D, basically. So for a film that's, you know, was out 13 years ago that everyone has easy access to, 23 million is pretty good. And I think my guess is it'll probably, once people hear, you know, reviews from people about the 3D and stuff, I'm guessing next weekend we'll see a pretty consistent attendance. So I don't think it'll be one of those films that just drops off suddenly in attendance. So
yeah, and I think I totally had forgotten too, because the ticket was kind of expensive. A 3D movie is more expensive than your average movie. So people aren't going to probably go see it a dozen times like they did. Even when Revenge of the Sith came out, I could still get a movie ticket for like $6. I could afford to go see that like five times. I can't afford
exactly
$15.50 like four times. Like, I just don't have that kind of money.
Right.
So. Mm. But anywho, long story short, it was great to have it back.
It was. And I'm really looking forward. It definitely has me looking forward to the rest of the films in 3D. Definitely looking forward to Attack of the Clones next year.
I know you are.
So Jedi action.
Yes. You are going to be going nuts.
Oh, yes. Yes, I am. But I freely admit that. But we did want to mention, before we jumped into our whole discussion on The Phantom Menace in general, we did want to talk a bit about some of the hype that accompanied this film back in late 1998 and in 1999 leading up to the release. And I wasn't, I was probably, well, how old was I? 9, 10 years old at the time when it was all being hyped and things like that. So, and I was, you know, busy being a kid, and I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the hype. I knew they were making a new one because my parents told me after we were done seeing the special editions, they told me, well, they're making a new one, but it'll be a couple of years because they still have to make it all from scratch. So I was like, oh, okay. But leading up in the month or two, two or three months before the film was released, you could not walk anywhere without seeing something for The Phantom Menace. And so I remember getting excited about that because I kept seeing, Darth Maul on packages, Jar Jar on packages, Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, Anakin, they were just everywhere. From chip bags to cereal boxes to toothbrushes, and you could not go down the deodorant aisle, basically, without finding something with Star Wars on it. You couldn't step out of your house without something flying by that said Star Wars, The Phantom Menace, So it was just nuts, the hype that was going on. I didn't pay too much attention to it. But by the time we went and saw the film, I was very excited and I was very pleased upon seeing it. But I don't know if you want to talk about the hype beforehand, before you saw the film.
You know, like you said, you know, in early 99 there, you couldn't go anywhere without being, you know, affronted with the image of Darth Maul and Jar Jar Binks, who we knew literally nothing about. It makes me think of one of the funniest scenes in Fanboys, the movie Fanboys, which is great. It was supposed to come out, you know, before The Phantom Menace did, because it lost some of its hype that way. But there's that one scene where Seth Rogen, he's playing the one character who's a Star Wars fan. He has this huge tattoo on his back of Jar Jar Binks. And he points at it and he says, "This is going to be the new favorite," basically saying, like, "This is going to be the new, you know, most, you know, BA character in all Star Wars." It's just so funny because I think, in general, most people weren't crazy about Jar Jar after the film. But
I was, but I,
yes,
I'm not.
You were, yes.
So.
But
like anyway. I said, I'm not normal, so.
But yeah, no, the thing I remember most about the hype for The Phantom Menace, again, was, like you said, you know, this is a Star Wars film for us. Like, I was 14 years old when it came out. So, you know, just getting past that age of, you know, still playing with toys. But I still was at the time. And, you know, I mean, I'd been a diehard Star Wars fan for, you know, a good 5-6 years before this anyway. So it was just so exciting to think, like, wow, here we go, a Star Wars saga for my generation. But the thing that I'll always remember the most about it was basically the Duel of the Fates music video that was on TRL for, I think, a couple weeks before the movie came out. And, you know, the Duel of the Fates video, I think, gave us more shots of the film than the trailer did, because it's a longer, you know, longer song than the trailer was. The song was amazing. The images were great. And also, there was the toys that came out. I think they came out the week before the film as well. And I just loved those toys. I mean, I loved the Darth Maul action figure. I was like, what is this thing? This guy is so cool. I can't wait to see who he is in the film. And it was just so much fun buying those toys before the film came out. And as well as the soundtrack, too. And I always remember the big uproar. I never read the paper much as a child, but there was something in, I don't know what magazine it was in, but how a lot of people were kind of ticked off because the soundtrack, one of the names of the songs was Qui-Gon's Noble End. And people are like, wow, way to spoil that for us before the movie comes out. but I loved the music, too. I won't talk much about the music, hint, hint, for later. You know, I loved the soundtrack and these toys, and I just couldn't wait to get into the film. But I think the most important thing I wanted to say, though, before we do jump into the film itself, is the amount of hype. Again, this movie was more hyped than probably any movie in history. And there was no way George Lucas could have made a film to live up to that hype, which I think is why it's extremely important to remember that when people, you know, critique it so heavily. Like, yes, it has its pitfalls, but the amount of hype going into this film is, it's almost, you know, it's a fool's errand to meet it. It's just not possible.
Right. It's something that once George Lucas started promoting it, it just got completely out of hand and away from him, as far as I can tell. And it just, I mean, I remember there being like all sorts of like toys that you could collect from like KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, and there was like a whole collection of like 12 of these toys that you could get from these three locations, or maybe it was more, I don't remember, but it was just you, and there was soda cans and everything. I remember collecting the soda cans.
Oh yeah, I do too.
We would go and just buy a six pack of soda that we didn't even drink just so we could get the cans. And I would go like down, there was like a ditch behind our house, and I would walk down there and see if anybody dropped one, you know. And I found like three or four of them that way.
Jason was willing to be a hobo for Phantom Menace.
And I think we've still got them in storage somewhere. But it was just something that the hype was uncontrollable. And like out of this universe crazy. And so there's no way that the film could have lived up to it. There's just no possible way. It could have been, you know, the best, it could have been the best film of the year, and it still wouldn't have lived up to the hype. Of course, in my humble Star Wars addled mind opinion, it was the best film of the year, probably because it was one of the three or four movies I saw in the theaters that year. But it, there was no way, even if it was like the best movie of all time, like way better than any of the other Star Wars films, there was no way it was going to live up to the hype. So, and I think people unfairly criticize it somewhat because of that. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I like that you mentioned those cans. I know exactly where all mine are still. I think I literally had every one because I had all my aunts on a mission for me collecting them as well. And I have them in a brown bag in my old treehouse in my dad's backyard. They're probably covered in like cobwebs and spider babies and grossness. But yeah, I forgot all about those.
I don't think we got all of them, but we got a lot of them. I think we were missing like four or six, probably like four or five, I think.
They had well over 20, I'm pretty sure.
I think there was a collection of 24 different characters.
Okay.
If I remember correctly. Wow, that's a lot of information to have stuck back in the back of my brain there. But anyway, enough reminiscing about soda cans.
Yes.
We have a movie to analyze.
We do indeed. Oh, man. Oh, yeah, I just found a link with all the characters and whatnot. I'll throw that on our Facebook page so people can look at it in case they forgot.
Throwback time.
Exactly.
But a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there was the Phantom Menace, and it was awesome. But we open up with the Phantom Menace, obviously. We're thrown into a political situation, which is something that we hadn't seen in the original trilogy, which I think took some people for a loop at first. But we're thrown into a political situation with a Trade Federation blocading a piece of peaceful planet of Naboo over a trade route dispute. And so the Jedi Knight and his apprentice, well, Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn, and Padawan Obi-Wan Kenobi, big name for previous Star Wars fans. People were very excited about that. I know I was. Show up to negotiate. And that's how the movie kicks off. So, I was completely, I remember seeing this, and I was just completely enthralled with the whole situation. The biggest thing I was looking forward to was, you know, the last movie that I had seen in theaters, the Star Wars movie I had seen in theaters, was obviously Return of the Jedi with the special edition release. And I was like, now I want to see the Jedi before they were all extinct. And so this, seeing Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan in action, the whole film, and then the Jedi Council later on in the film, just was like almost too much for me to handle. I was just so excited about it. I was just like, so that's the Jedi. I want to be a Jedi when I grow up, you know. But the political thing, even at like 10 years old, didn't faze me at all. And it didn't bother me in the least. So I don't know about you, but it didn't bother me at all. And I was like, oh, okay, I get it, you know. Even at the, you know, humble little age of 10.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think it didn't mean much to me when I was, you know, 14. To me, it was a new opening crawl that I didn't know every word to. That was one of the biggest aspects. And, you know, yes, it's very political based, and I know that, you know, annoys a lot of people. But, I mean, frankly, like, to me, yes, that's kind of the backdrop, but it's not really, it doesn't take away from the story at all. Like, it's not like this huge political head game. I mean, it's still Star Wars. It's still a drama. you know, again, I'm with you. I mean, the first scene of the film is essentially when they, you know, they land on this ship. I mean, again, it's all these ships we've never seen before, which is huge. Like, that's so cool. But then seeing Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, I absolutely loved this. I mean, literally, from the first time Qui-Gon opens his mouth, I'm like, this guy is awesome. This is probably one of the coolest characters in Star Wars. And I will still go to the, you know, I would still say that to this day. I mean, I love Qui-Gon Jinn. You know, I love they walk right into this conference room and automatically, like, Obi-Wan is, like, all anxious, you know. Oh, I feel a disturbance in the Force. It's like, really? The movie just started. Like, what's going on?
I have a bad feeling about this.
Yeah.
I don't sense anything. You
know? Yeah, and Qui-Gon just, like, pulls his focus back and, you know, he brings up this thing about being attentive to the living Force. I mean, here's this aspect of the Force we've never heard before, which I think is so cool. And also, we get a window into this master-apprentice relationship. It's nothing we've ever heard of, really, in you know, the original trilogy. Like, yes, Obi-Wan mentions that Yoda was a Jedi who instructed him, but I don't think we realized the extent of, you know, this master-apprentice relationship that is very clear. Like, this is how the Jedi Order was operated. It was a really cool way to start the film. I mean, it starts with the Jedi, what we've all been longing to see.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree that Qui-Gon is one of the best characters, if not the best character, to come out of The Phantom Menace. And he made such an impact on me as a character that every time I see Liam Neeson or hear Liam Neeson in anything else, I automatically think Qui-Gon Jinn. Whether he's in, like, Taken.
Yes.
Yeah, that's Harrison Ford. Taken, where his daughter is kidnapped overseas, or in the A-Team, or hearing him voice Aslan in The Chronicles of Narnia, I still think Qui-Gon Jinn. It's not Liam Neeson running around being chased by wolves and whatever that movie was that just came out. No, that's Qui-Gon Jinn fighting off wolves, you know. I don't remember the name of that movie that just came out.
The Gray,
him.
I believe.
The Gray, yeah, that's it. And then, of course, we've got these new villains, these sniveling little slimy, dirty, underhanded Nemoidians, these Trade Federation types. They're cowards, you know. The negotiation's going to be short. Sorry. It's a totally, almost a different type of villain that we've never seen before in Star Wars. But then, of course, we quickly find out that they are being manipulated by the Sith, which is an all too familiar situation that we've seen. I think that was something that sort of jarred some people as well, was the Nemoidians and them being the primary antagonists for this film, which I thought they were pretty cool, kind of silly people at 10. I was just like, oh, that's kind of funny, but they're kind of cool too. I remember getting both Newt Gunray and Rune Hakko action figures like that year. So I thought they were, you know, kind of cool. I thought their voices were kind of funny. I could probably start talking like Newt Gunray at some point during this. So just be forewarned.
Yeah, I agree. Like the Nemoidians are not... they're certainly not the most intimidating bad guys we've ever seen in Star Wars. I mean, again, you know, forecast that, you know, mirror this to the first villains we see in A New Hope, you know, when they come crashing into the, you know, the Tana IV, and it's these, you know, soldiers with no faces, these stormtroopers, and then Darth Vader, you know, this horrifying character all in black. And these Nemoidians are like these, kind of like these, basically like these dorky bankers that just have a lot of money and therefore have, you know, military might behind them. But they themselves are not that intimidating until they contact Lord Sidious. And then Darth Sidious, you know, is right there on the screen in the first couple minutes of the film. And it's so apparent. I remember people debating this, you know, back in 99, you know, ooh, is Darth Sidious is that Palpatine? It's like, yes, fools. Like, how can you not tell? Like, it's clearly his face. It's clearly his voice. I don't think they were trying to keep that secret. But what's so cool about it is he comes right on the scene and here's somebody to be afraid of. His voice is intimidating. There's something dark to him. And, you know, he's very in control. You know, he's the one manipulating things, you know. You know, begin landing your troops. Is that legal? I will make it legal. Oh, I can't do that voice. Jason, I'm
begin open. Begin landing your troops. My lord, is that legal? I will make it legal.
Oh, man.
And the Jedi? The Chancellor should never have brought them into this. Kill them immediately. Yes, my lord. As you wish.
So good. Yeah, and... He, you know, it's so clear, you know, he says, I will make it legal. Like, who is this guy? How will he make this legal? Like, he's pulling all the strings. That's horrifying. It's, you know, it's so good. Yeah. And just a quick little, not to get off topic, but a quick little note about Rune Hako and, oh my God, this is embarrassing.
Newt Gunray.
Newt Gunray, thank you. I think that they look awesome. One of my favorite things about these two characters is the fact that they aren't CGI. It kind of just reminded me of a lot of the alien creatures we saw, like, back in Mos Eisley's, you know, cantina. Like, they just look real by the fact that they're not CGI. There's a realism to them. That just makes them look really cool. I really liked them. But
that's not to mention that they were portrayed and voiced very well.
Right.
But you mentioned real quick that there were people in 1999 wondering if it was or wasn't Palpatine, if Darth Sidious was or wasn't Palpatine. I didn't even know that controversy, that little debate was going on until a couple of years ago when somebody told me about it. I was like, really? Apparently some people even thought that it was like a twin or something, an evil twin or something like that. But I remember walking out of the theater and we were talking about the film on the way home and my dad asked, so were Darth Sidious and Palpatine played by the same person? And I was like, oh yeah, they were played by the same person. It's the same character. And, you know, I was like, well, I know this is the same character because I, you know, he knew.
Yeah.
But I was like, he was just wondering if it was played by the same person. And I was like, oh yes, they're the same character. I mean, Emperor Palpatine, Senator Palpatine, he's the Sith Lord. I mean, it's the same costume. So at 10 years old, I was like, duh. So I knew throughout the entire prequel trilogy that, you know, what was coming down the pike. But I knew everything back then. At least I thought I did. but then, of course, we finally get to see Jedi in action. You know, Newt Gunray has been ordered to kill Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan. And after trying to gas them out, the Jedi jump out and we are introduced to the battle droids, which are pathetic excuses of stormtroopers. because the Jedi just sort of cut them to shreds, which was awesome. And then Qui-Gon just cutting through the door and they kept having to close more doors and more doors because he kept getting closer and closer. And the destroyer droids coming in and finally the Jedi having to run off with force speed, which was surprising at first to see. Because the destroyer droids had shields, you know, that whole sequence there was just so much fun for me. And I was just like, oh, that's awesome. That was when I decided I wanted to be a Jedi when I grew up.
Yeah, good. I love that scene as well. I mean, the film starts with a great action sequence. And the thing I really like about the way, like, Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan fight, you know, if you compare this, their lightsaber actions, you know, against, of course, the battle droids are kind of a pathetic excuse, as you said, for stormtroopers. And I think that's kind of the point, too, is like, you know, because people could easily ask, why not just, you know, pay to build battle droids to fight, you know, in the Empire? It's like, well, because they're garbage. Like, they're absolutely terrible. And we see that. But at the same time, I love the way Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan fight. The thing that I kind of – okay, like, if you compare that little opening fight to maybe Luke's, you know, battle against Jabba's henchmen on the skiffs in the sail barge, You know, the way Luke fights, again, yes, he's still very young and new to the lightsaber, but he's almost like, he like hacks people. That's how I look at it. It's like, he uses it almost like a broadsword where he just hacks people, where there's this grace and fluidity to the way Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan fight. I mean, it's so graceful. I mean, it's, yes, part of it I think is the amazing choreography by Nick Gillard, but at the same time, like, just the way they fight, it's so refined and it's absolutely awesome. Like, it's just so cool. And again, yeah. It's a very, very early introduction to the fact that these are the Jedi. You don't mess with them because they will own you.
Exactly.
So, but yeah, I mean, again, in the film, you know, essentially the film starts with, you know, there's all these huge, this huge opening to what is going on here. You know, you have Darth Sidious, who's pulling strings from the background, and Obi-Wan, who's aware of something bigger, a bigger disturbance in the Force. And I really like that. But at the same time, Qui-Gon is the one who kind of brings everything back to the moment. You know, he says, you know, focus here. You know, this is what's important right now. We'll get to the bigger picture later. And I just think that's so great. That's such a great way of storytelling. George Lucas, again, he opens the story so intelligently. It's very clear that there's something going on a galactic scale, but it's going to be summed up in basically the lives of a few characters. You know, we get focused right in. So I love that opening sequence.
Yeah. And then, of course, they get down on the planet by stowing aboard the invasion army fleet, you know, ships, all the ships flying down onto Naboo, accompanied with the invasion march that John Williams came up with, was just awesome to look at. And then, of course, Qui-Gon's running through the forest, the swamps, and runs literally into Jar Jar. So I don't know if you wanted to mention anything before that, but nope. You know, obviously this is our introduction to Jar Jar, who hangs out with us for, you know, the rest of the movie, basically, much to some people's chagrin and my thorough enjoyment of it. I don't know. I loved the way he talked. I loved the way he acted. I liked the fact that he was funny. And then, of course, on the top of that, like I've stated before, I identified with Jar Jar Binks, so sue me. But you know, it was a nice little sort of an interesting little introduction to our main sidekick for the film. So I thought he was a clever. Not a clever character in that Jar Jar's clever, but a clever character in a way, the way that they introduced him and stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah, no, and that's, you know, next thing I was going to mention as well. You know, we meet Jar Jar Binks. This character, again, if you rewind to May 19th, 99, you know, rewind back to the fact that we didn't know who the heck this character was that we'd been, you know, berated with images of for months. And here we meet him. And he's this just goofy character. And at first, you know, I actually did really like him. One of my favorite things actually about Jar Jar, too, is I love his theme music. But that's, again, something I'll talk about later. Hint, hint. Like what I'm doing there. But, I personally, and we did talk about this a little bit in our last show, so I don't have to say much about it. I personally am not crazy about Jar Jar. But I do, especially in light of what you said last week, Jason, I certainly have more of an appreciation for him. I didn't find myself, when I was just watching it in theaters this past weekend, you know, I didn't find myself annoyed by the character. I didn't expect to love him, and I didn't, again, but I didn't, like, go, oh my God, I can't stand this guy. His character does, you know, have a point. And the thing that I like about it, especially in this sequence of the film, is here's Qui-Gon, you know, bumping into this, what we'd consider a brainless person. Ah, Speck! The ability to speak does not make you intelligent. Now get out of here.
Like, no, he's a stay.
Yeah. So, you know, he's so quick to, like, offer his life up to Qui-Gon for saving his. And Qui-Gon responds to that. Qui-Gon, you know, again, I like it because Jar Jar is meant to be kind of this clumsy, character who gets in the way. Yet Qui-Gon is so, again, this is something I'll talk about a couple times probably, but he's so open to the Force that he's capable of seeing the goodness in Jar Jar. So he lets him pal around. And again, this is going to be to their benefit because then he takes him down to Ato Gunga, which is the next thing I was going to talk about. But I'll let you go ahead if you want to say something else here.
No, that's fine. And I remember back in 1999, and then of course just this past weekend, watching them swim down to Otagunga, and I was just completely loving the idea of a city underwater to begin with, and then seeing it in 1999, just these glowing bubbles underwater, this huge expansive city. And then, of course, seeing it in 3D this past weekend made it even look even cooler. These bubble cities that you could just, like, go through the walls. There was just, you could just, like, walk through the walls, the bubble wall, which I thought was awesome. And, of course, we meet the rest of the Gungans, and, they're not exactly keen on Jar Jar. And Boss Nos doesn't look like Jar Jar at all. My favorite little moments there, in the first bit that they introduce the city and the Otagunga, is the interchange between Jar Jar and Captain Tarples.
Hey to the Captain Tarples, meet you back.
No again, Jar Jar. You start going to the buses. You start being doo-doo this time.
And then he gets zapped and... What? How rude! It's funny because, this is later expanded on in some of the Star Wars Tales comics, but Jar Jar and Captain Tarples go way back. So Captain Tarples knows exactly who Jar Jar is, and he's like, "Oh, not again!" This time I'm giving you just to the higher ups because I'm done dealing with you. I don't know. It's just I like that interchange there. It's just a funny little interchange. And of course we get to introduce to Boss Nos, and we've seen the Naboo already. We've seen Queen Amidala talk with Palpatine and that whole side of things. But now we find out from Boss Nos that the Gungans and the Naboo, even though they live on the same planet, they don't like each other. They're not particularly fond of the other. And, Obi-Wan sort of mentions, well, you form a symbiont circle. What happens to one of you is going to affect the other. And, they just sort of we sort of care about the Naboo. They don't care. It's we may be connected, but we don't like each other at all. That doesn't matter. They can deal with the droids up there, the mechaniques, by themselves. We don't want to help.
Yeah.
I'll let you go ahead and talk about that if you want to.
Yeah, just to recap, I love the swim down to Otagunga. I mean, it's such a cool city. I've always been fascinated with the ocean and, like, underwater and stuff. And, like, what a cool place to live. A place, like you said, literally, you can just walk through the walls and you're in the ocean. Like, it just looks beautiful. I mean, to me, it's one of the most captivating scenes in all of Star Wars. And again, this is where we really get to meet the Gungan race. And they're a very proud race, almost to a fault, though. And that's what Obi-Wan basically is going to call them out on, and what I like about this what we see very early on, Obi-Wan's ability as a negotiator, he's trying to make sense out of this for them. Like, look at, if you don't help, they're coming for you next. Like, don't seem to think that your lack of involvement is going to keep you in the free and clear. Like, this is an oppressive force. They're going to take care of you too. But, it's like Boss Nass and the Gungans have built up, this arrogant shield, if you will, that they are incapable of seeing the fact that this is going to affect them as well. I like that. I mean, the Gungans are, they're a very cool race, but at the same time, like, they're overly proud. He makes it clear they don't like the Naboo, and, they're not going to do anything to help.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And then
of course, yeah. to to move things along, Qui-Gon just sort of mind tricks Boss Nass into giving him a ship and, you know, let Jar Jar go with them. You know, he's like, you know, I'm tired of trying to deal with you. Just give me what I want so we can get out of here. You know, he's just like, you know, a very casual use of, almost a very casual use of the mind trick. I don't know if Obi-Wan would have used the mind trick there, but at least not at this stage in time. But Qui-Gon's just like, then just speed us on our way, give us a ship, and Jar Jar, he's got a life debt to me, so let him come with me.
Yeah.
So,
what I like about this too is, you know, Qui-Gon, the way he just, like you said, so casually whips out the mind trick, but he does it, you know, in a non-harmful way, though. I mean, why didn't he try to, you know, mind trick him into listening to him and Obi-Wan? You know, oh, you know, you should be helping the Naboo. Oh, we should be helping the Naboo. You know, he doesn't use the Force in such a way that he tries to take control of the fate of this planet. He simply just uses it here to, all right, they're not going to listen to us. There's no sense in wasting our time here. We need to get on to the next party. So get us out of here. And he agrees to it, and off they go, which I really like. Again, this is, again, Qui-Gon is such an, you know, a wise character. I mean, all right, they're not going to listen. I'm not going to trick them into doing something they don't want to do. They've made up their mind. I'm just going to at least speed things along and, you know, get us out of here.
Of course, Boss Nass tries to do the slightly underhanded thing by sending him through the planet's core, you know. And we find out that from Jar Jar, just before they leave the room, that maybe that's not exactly the best path, you know.
Yeah.
Count me out of this one. Better dead here than dead at the core. Then guys, what it means the same.
You know. Sorry. But we go through the planet's core, which is a really cool sequence with all the sea monsters and everything. You know, this is our obligatory, you know, monster meetup that we have in Star Wars. I think the only film that we don't have some sort of a monster encounter in Star Wars is Revenge of the Sith. But this is totally different because none of the other monsters that we ever see in the films are underwater. And so because they're underwater, they can be huge. And they just keep getting bigger. You know, there's always a bigger fish, you know?
Yeah.
And they're so unique, which is really cool. So, and of course, two of them get eaten by the same guy. So that's even funnier.
Yeah. The planet core sequence is actually probably my least favorite part of the film. And I think the reason the reason I don't enjoy it is because to me it's kind of analogous to like a car chase scene in a movie. And I hate car chases. I don't utterly hate it. I don't even fast forward or anything. But actually my favorite part of the entire sequence is, again, has to do with Qui-Gon. You know, Jar Jar's, you know, freaking out. There's all these crazy monsters. And, you know, he asks Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, which is funny. He's supposed to be the guide, yet he asks, where are we so going? And Qui-Gon says, don't worry, the Force will guide us. Again, this is why I love Qui-Gon's character so much. Here's this guy, you know, he doesn't know exactly where he's going. Jar Jar clearly doesn't know where the heck they're going. And they're being chased by these, you know, huge monsters and creatures, yet he's still so calm because Qui-Gon is ultimately so grounded in the Force. I mean, to me, this is what a Jedi is. It's a person who's so confident in the Force that they trust in the will of the Force. And that's why I think Qui-Gon is probably one of the most respected Jedi in the entire order. You know, so I love that little line of his, you know, don't worry, the Force will guide us. And he really means that. It's not just it's not like some hokey little line. I mean, it's paramount to who Qui-Gon's character is. It's a man who trusts the Force.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that. You know, he doesn't doubt that they'll get out of this situation. And of course he's right.
So. Right. And then of course, you know, a few scenes, like a scene or two later, you know, they're rocketing out of the tunnel and Jar Jar's freaking out again. And of course, Qui-Gon just puts his hand on Jar Jar's shoulder and just relax, you know, uses the Force to make Jar Jar relax, and Jar Jar slumps over in his chair with his eyes crossed and everything, which is makes me laugh every time. I don't know, seeing a Gungan with cross eyes is just a funny image.
Yeah, I bet you Qui-Gon gives a great back rub.
But moving on, after our monster chase in the planet's core, we get to Theed, and the Trade Federation has arrived on the capital, and because they're a peaceful planet, the Naboo are all getting rounded up, every single one of them, including Queen Amidala, and all of her royal court, and we find out that Newt Gunray is extremely confident and pompous in his victory, that, you know, oh, yes, the Queen and I are going to sign a treaty that will legitimize our occupation here. You know, and I have assurances it will be ratified by the Senate. Of course, you know, he's not going to, you know, he just assumes everything's going to fall in place because this queen's only 14 years old. I mean, come on, how difficult can she be to deal with? But, you know, she's not going to cooperate. She doesn't want to cooperate. And, you know, he's like, oh, come on, please, you know. You know, almost that mustache twirling villain at this point. He's like, really, come on. But, you know, and the whole sequence there with the Trade Federation coming in and invading and everything, it's you know, almost a sad because Theed is such a picturesque location, and now you've just got tanks and, you know, droids flooding it everywhere, and people are being marched in, like, strict, you know, straight rows through the city on their way to concentration camps and things like that. It's almost a sad-looking situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, kind of cool, too, so.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's a very clear scene of being introduced to slavery. I mean, you know, he says process them. I mean, it's like they literally are being set off to concentration camps or something of that nature. You know, they've just lost their freedom. And, you know, Newt Gunray, like you said, he's so confident that they're in control. But what he doesn't realize, like any naive ruler who tries to oppress the people, is you've just given them a reason to overthrow you. And they hate you now. You know,
exactly.
You say you're here under legitimate reasons. You know, you have reasons to be blockading the planet. All that was still up for debate, but now you've invaded and oppressed the people. Good luck. You know, now you've just given them a reason to hate you and and rise up against you. So yeah, and you know that the sequences up until we basically leave, I just thought again is cool. Probably one of the coolest lightsaber moves in all of Star Wars is when Qui-Gon, you know, cuts the one droid in half, twirls his lightsaber casually back to his belt, and then flicks two fingers and sends the other droids just flying. It's like, do not mess with Qui-Gon Jinn. It's so cool.
It's such a simple move. He just sort of slices as he turns his lightsaber off, attaches it to his belt, and just sort of like waves his fingers across like it's, you know, swatting at a, like, flicking a fly away, and two battle droids, you know, first of all, the battle droid in front of him is hacked to pieces, and the other two are just fly backwards into the wall there, and they just, you know, this sort of anguished mechanical squawk comes out of them, which is, you know they're dead now. and then, of course, Obi-Wan has to give his little flourish after cutting down droids, you know, the twirls the lightsaber a couple times and then turns it off. You know, he's younger, he has to show off a bit, you know, he hasn't learned how to just do the simple, cool move like Qui-Gon has yet. But then, of course, they escape, you know, they decide to leave Naboo, you know, the queen is going, Silent Dibble's going to stay, try and work things out, you know. Our only hope is for the Senate to side with us. Senator Palpatine will need your help. You know, and so they blast off after fighting their way through droids. Another cool sequence. And they hit the blockade. Well, actually, the blockade hits them. they get shot, and we are introduced to the hero of the Star Wars saga, R2-D2.
You do love R2.
I do. He is my favorite character of all time. overall. So, but it's such an epic introduction to the character. If you're watching the story from, you know, 1 through 6, it's such a cool introduction to R2-D2, who up until this point, all droids that we've seen are either basically just battle droids. And so we don't care about any of them. And then we just meet R2-D2, and automatically he's this heroic little droid that has so much personality, and saves the ship in order for them to escape the blockade. So I just thought that whole sequence was just phenomenally fun and amazing, and I love R2. That's all I'm going to say. And the fact that he ran into Jar Jar to get to the, you know, to get to the little lift in time. He just runs over Jar Jar because Jar Jar's in the way. He, you know, he's like, get out of my way, I'm busy. So he just runs over Jar Jar.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry.
Go ahead. I was going to say, you know, this is basically the big aspect of the whole getting out of the blockade is, like you said, we're introduced to R2-D2, and we find out essentially, you know, evidently he was built by people on Naboo, and he belongs to the Queen, and, you know, he saves the day, of course, like he always does. It's great to finally meet this OT character and get, you know, this is really, you know, one of the most iconic characters in Star Wars, and here we get to meet, you know, where he's from originally. So that was really cool. And they obviously make this decision to go to Tatooine. And, you know, you can't take a Royal Highness there. The huts are gangsters. Oh, Panaka, quiet down.
I know.
I love how they, you know, they go to Tatooine. And again, Tatooine in the Star Wars galaxy, and you know, if you're a character living in the Star Wars galaxy, Tatooine is this backward planet that nobody goes to. You know, it means nothing. Yet it is the single most important planet in the Star Wars saga, and I love that. To me, it's I can't help but think about, excuse me for the biblical reference here, but it, you know, in one of the books of the prophet in the Old Testament, where they basically have this line about, oh, Bethlehem, you who are so low and humble, you will be the home of the Messiah. Like, you know, basically Bethlehem's this little, nobody goes to town in little Israel, and from it will come this great king. Well, basically that's what Tatooine kind of is. Tatooine is this backward planet nobody gives a crap about. And from this planet, we're going to essentially get the Chosen One. And, you know, the entire fate of the galaxy is affected by this backward planet. Again, it just goes to show that the things we don't expect to mean much often, you know, affect us in ways we would never have thought possible. So I love this going to Tatooine so quickly, and it's going to, you know, decide the fate of our main heroes as it is. You know, oh, they need to find a hyperdrive, so let's go to Tatooine. And, oh, geez, this is a terrible place to be.
Right. So Qui-Gon, Jar Jar, Padme, secretly Queen Amidala, obviously, and R2-D2 wind their way into Mos Espa and wind up in Watto's junk shop. And Watto is such a great character. I love Watto as a character.
I do too.
But he's this little blue bug that flies around. I don't know. Tordarian. But he's just like this little big-nosed blue bug that just sort of hovers there. Big old bumblebee, you know. And it's so funny. And the voice that I can't remember the actor who does his voice, but it's such a great voice for the character. And we find out that he's got the hyperdrive, but he's also got this little slave kid. We find out that there's slavery in the galaxy out here on Tatooine. And he's got this little kid who's a slave named Anakin. And while Qui-Gon and Watto are out in the back haggling, and Jar Jar is getting in trouble by, you know, playing with pit droids, Anakin strikes up a conversation with Padme with one of the best pickup lines known to mankind.
Yes.
Are you an angel?
Yeah, I use that at the bar all the time.
That would explain your black eyes. just kidding, Carl. But, you know, we find out a little bit more about Anakin, how he's, you know, this whiz with machinery, how he can repair anything, and, you know, how he and his mom were, you know, bet back and forth. And Padme's just, like, really out of her element, obviously, grown up in the royal houses of Naboo, being in a junk shop, talking to a slave on a desert world where there's no law, is really out of her element. So I just think that's that whole sequence, you know, while incredibly corny dialogue, is still kind of an interesting little scene there.
Oh,
so,
absolutely. Yeah. And like you said, you know, when we first walk into the shop, we meet Watto, and Watto, I think, is one of the best characters in the prequels. I just love him. And like you said, his voice is perfect. This grungy junk shop guy who's had one too many cigarettes, you know what I mean? His voice is so gravelly, and he's great. Yeah, you know, so as he and Qui-Gon step out back, you do have this awkward exchange between this 9-year-old kid who's just, he's obviously, like, he's already, like, you know, in love with this girl he just saw. And again, it's young love. It's easy to, you know, be infatuated with somebody very quickly. But we learn so much about him. You know, I mean, he obviously is comfortable with her. He goes on to tell her, you know, he's a slave. And, you know, he kind of tells her a little bit of his backstory right there in their first meeting. This is, you know, if one of my friends came to me and told me they had a bad date and then they told me about all this information they shared, I'd be like, well, you're an overshare. Nobody likes that. So Anakin doesn't realize not only has he had the worst pickup line, but he's an overshare. He's going to freak her out. It's too much too soon. Relax, little guy.
But of course she can't tell he's infatuated with her. So she's just like, oh, that's such a cute little kid, you know?
Exactly.
So
yeah.
She'll listen.
Right. Right. But like you said, you know, we find out that Anakin is a slave, and Padme's so out of her element here. And also this slave identity is how, you know, this is going to affect Anakin the rest of his life, like we've talked about on some of our other shows. But, you know, he and his mother have been objects of Gardula the Hutt and other objects of Watto. I mean, they've been passed around. You know, it's a pretty rough life. I mean, these are, you know, your childhood is your formative years to who you're going to become as an adult. And Anakin's have basically been, you know, for 9-10 years, he's been the product of someone else. He's been, you know, he's been the object of somebody else. And, you know, that's going to be problematic for him later on.
Right. But I do want to mention a little bit about Qui-Gon and Watto out back, because it's kind of funny, because Qui-Gon tries to use the mind trick on Watto when he finds out that the Republic credits. The Republic credits are not good out here. I need something more real, you know. No, credits will be fine. No, they won't. Credits will be fine. No, they won't. What, you think I've got a Jedi waving your hand around like that? I'm a Toydarian. Mind tricks don't work on me. Only money. No money, no parts, no deal. You know, my Watto's not the greatest, but we find out that there are some species that are immune to Jedi mind tricks, and Watto is one of them, and all he wants is the money. So that throws a wrench in Qui-Gon's plan. Real fast.
Oh, yeah.
I love that scene between Qui-Gon and Watto.
I do, too. Yeah, it's just, it's so funny. I mean, it's like they're two businessmen, and Qui-Gon's been, you know, there's nothing Qui-Gon can do here. This isn't like Boss Nass, where he was able to just kind of get what he wanted to get out of there. Now he's forced into doing something else. And just think, I think that's both an intelligent plot point, but even more than that, it's really cool that the fact that Watto is you know, not susceptible to the Force, because it's almost like the Force is working through this. Because if, let's say, you know, that worked and Watto sold him the part, boom, they're gone, you know? Anakin would have never been who he was, which I think is just so cool. You know, it's almost like the Force makes Watto impervious so that Qui-Gon is forced to stick around a little bit longer and then, you know, bump into Anakin again and, you know, sit down for dinner with him. You know, it's gonna really that one little thing, the one little fact that Qui-Gon isn't able to use the Force on Watto changes the entire, you know, sequence of events for the story. So,
right.
But then just real quick, the little scene back on the Trade Federation battleship where they have to confess that, you know, Newt Gunray has to confess to Sidious that he's lost the Queen, and we meet Darth Maul, which was awesome. What a great scene, you know. Oh, they're out of our range. Not for a Sith.
Not for the Sith.
This is my apprentice.
This is my apprentice, Darth Maul. He will find your lost ship.
And it's just, it was awesome. Darth Maul was such a cool character. And you're like, okay, this guy's going to hunt them. He looks like the devil. Awesome. You know?
Yeah. And I don't know if it was deliberate or if they just didn't notice it when they were recording, but Newt Gunray's hat is pushed slightly farther back on his head that scene, which just sort of gives him the impression that he's just sweating the entire conversation, you know, sweating in nervous fear the entire conversation. But it's... And the not only is that was, you know, Sidious and Darth Maul cool, but my favorite line at the end of that scene is, you know,
now
we should not have made this bargain. This whole thing is now that they're already too far in it, the Nemoidians are realizing, oh, we really are over our hats, you know, in this. So yeah. Not over their heads, over their hats.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you make a deal with the Sith, it never goes well. Just ask Lando.
exactly.
But, yeah, but then, you know, we have this little scene where we meet Sebulba and Jar Jar and him getting their little scuffle. Then, you know, basically Anakin comes to the rescue of Jar Jar and, you know, and we see a little bit of what kind of character this kid is. I mean, there's the sandstorm kicking up, so Anakin says, well, just come back to my place. It's no big deal. You know, I mean, he doesn't even know these people, yet he welcomes them into his home. I mean, there's this level of hospitality to Anakin that, you know, it's maybe it's part of the fact that he's young and naive, but he opens his home to these complete strangers, offering them shelter, which I think is, you know, this is one of the first actions we see of Anakin Skywalker, and it's extremely compassionate.
Yeah, and not only that, but he has glimpsed Qui-Gon's lightsaber and knows exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So that makes him even
more curious.
Laser
sword. That always bugged me. I was like, why is he calling it a laser sword? It's a lightsaber. Come on, idiot.
Well, he's out on the back world. That's so true. You know, somebody's just, you know, some drunk came in and he started talking about it. And he's like, the laser sword, you know, whatever. He can't say lightsaber, so he just says laser sword. So that's what Anakin calls it. You know, I don't know, something.
I like this backstory you just created. Good work.
Thank you. You know, I like backstories. Maybe that's why I like the EU a lot. Or at least finding out about all these characters. But yeah, he takes them back to his home, which is an extremely generous and compassionate thing. And this is where we meet Shmi, who is, you know, obviously his mom, but is a very, obviously later on, a very pivotal person for Anakin. But she's this graceful mother figure that just sort of, we never had before in the Star Wars films, in the original trilogy. So I think that's one of the nice things that the prequel trilogy brought, is that we had this other role that was able to be filled by Shmi. And then the way that she and Qui-Gon end up interacting was they had a lot of really good chemistry there. So on set. So that was... those scenes with her, I thought were always very good and very well done. But they act. Sorry, I totally lost my train of thought there. But after Anakin just surprises his mom with all these people, he drags Padme into his room to show her C-3PO.
He didn't even like try to like take her out to dinner first or anything. It's like right to the room, you know? Like, Anakin, take it easy.
But of course he's 9, so that means I gotta show you all my cool stuff.
Right.
So, and, you know, he even mentions that, you know, and I've got a pod racer out back. I'll show it to you after the storm's over. So we find out more that, you know, even more that this kid's, you know, a whiz with machinery. And we meet C-3PO. And R2-D2 meets C-3PO for the first time. And calls 3PO naked. I beg your pardon, but what do you mean, naked? My parts are showing. My goodness, you know. I just love the introduction to C-3PO. You know how unsteady he is. You know, I'm not sure this floor is entirely stable. You know, and just his whole introduction was just a really nice little way to introduce us to this character who we'll get to know much, much better as the films progress. So
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And an interesting little twist that we find out that he was built by Anakin Skywalker, you know, Darth Vader. So right. that was one of the biggest twists, I think, for people seeing the movie for the first time in 1999 was, wait, Darth Vader built C-3PO? You know, that just opens up whole new things, you know. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, I personally, that's one of the plot points I don't really care for. I don't like the fact that Anakin Skywalker built C-3PO. I think it works well for the prequel trilogy. I just think it makes things weird, though, for the original trilogy. But overall, it's not that big a deal for me. I don't really care. One of my favorite paintings, though, I've seen is there's this painting somebody did of Darth Vader in Cloud City. And he's holding C-3PO's head. It's after C-3PO, you know, gets shot to pieces and before Chewbacca finds him. But there's this scene of Darth Vader, like, clasping C-3PO's head to his helmet. It's really cool. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I have. I think that might have been from a comic book.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a really nice little drawing there, illustration there. And it's
at the same time, I guess one of the reasons I do kind of like it is I was always curious, and not to get too off topic, but I was always curious as to in Empire Strikes Back when Boba Fett goes to shoot Chewbacca in the carbonite chamber, why Vader pulls his blaster down. I wonder if maybe because he didn't want him to hit 3PO. I mean, we don't know.
I've heard someone else put forward that theory now too. So I think you're like the second or third person I've heard say that. So I say. Well, since it's, you know, from multiple sources now, we'll put that in as, you know, a very likely motive for Vader's action there. But we'll just slip that into canon there for those of us that care about that kind of stuff. So we'll just make that canon. I wish we could do that. That would be fun. But but anyway,
yeah. Then we have this dinner scene. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about before that?
No, that was where I was going next.
But we have this dinner scene, you know, with Anakin and Shmi and our heroes, Qui-Gon, Jar Jar, and Padme. And again, but it basically just reminds us of how compassionate Anakin is. Anakin is doing everything he can to try and help Qui-Gon and Padme. You know, there's a problem with your ship? Well, let me help. I can fix just about anything. But, you know, well, yes, I'm sure you can, but not without the parts. And, you know, he says to his mother, like, let me help them. Well, the only way you can help them is entering into this pod race, the Boontive race. And if you don't, you know, they're probably going to be, you know, out of luck. So Anakin pleads with his mother to let him help these people. And obviously she's reluctant at first, as she should be. I mean, this is her son. She doesn't want him doing something so dangerous. And again, Qui-Gon and Padme don't pressure at all. You know, Padme makes it very clear. You know, I'm sure Qui-Gon won't do anything to harm your son. But at the same time, Shmi, like, caves to Anakin's little line. You know, like, Mom, you always said the biggest problem in this galaxy is nobody's willing to help each other. And then that's all he needs to say. He's like, so think about that, Mom. And it's like she caves to that. And she's like, how can I bring my son up to be this moral, upright character and then stop him from doing something so selfless? So, you know, I think it's a great little sequence where we see Anakin just, you know, willingly giving, you know, dishing himself out for others. Maybe that's part to the fact that he's a slave, so people have always used him. But here he is. He's the one, though, who's taking control here. He's saying, let me do something with these talents of mine to help these people. And also, too, you know, it becomes apparent to Qui-Gon here, Anakin obviously has some type of force potential, just the fact that he can race pods. You know, you must have Jedi reflexes. You know, I mean, it's very apparent that there's something special about this kid. So.
Yeah. Oh, and of course, Anakin reveals that he knows Qui-Gon's a Jedi, and so they have to tell the entire story of what's going on, which, you know, almost further unintentionally paints Shmi into a corner about, you know, having Anakin help. But I just one little point. I think it's funny how, you know, Qui-Gon tells Anakin, you know, well, you must have Jedi reflexes if you race pods. And then almost without looking, just grabs Jar Jar's tongue, demonstrating his own Jedi powers, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, right.
You know, as Jar Jar goes back for that second apple or plum or whatever it is there on the plate, you know, it's don't do that again. And then he just lets the tongue snap back in Jar Jar's mouth, which I laughed when I saw in theaters this past weekend again. So, but anyways. And then we get to, you know, Qui-Gon makes the deal with Watto for Anakin to race the pod. And, you know, they'll get the parts and Watto gets the rest of the winnings. And then we start getting to the pod race. And did you want to cover anything between them or not?
To me, one of the actually, I'll go quick, but to me, it's one of the most important conversations in The Phantom Menace is the conversation where Qui-Gon and Shmi talk about Anakin's birth.
Yes.
This is ripped right out of, you know, so many ancient religions. I mean, Christianity isn't the only religion with a story of a virginal birth. Obviously, it's the most famous, but you know, Qui-Gon makes it apparent to her, you know, there's something special about this boy. And, you know, he makes it very clear to her, look, if he was born anywhere else, he'd be a Jedi. You know, the amount of force potential in this kid, it's so darn apparent. And then he asks, you know, just an inquisitive question, who is his father? You know, maybe his father was a Jedi or something. And she says, oh, well, there really was no father. Oh, all right, that's common. Women giving birth without, you know, a man involved. That's pretty typical. But, you know, this, you know, Qui-Gon's, you know, antennae go right up here, you know. There is something extremely special about this boy. So, you know, this is a great plot point. This is not a point, you know, exclusive to George Lucas, but it's incredibly intelligent and making it very apparent, you know, there is something about this boy that is, you know, beyond comprehension. And basically the night before the pod race, he takes the blood sample, sends it to Obi-Wan, and, you know, the midichlorian count, which, again, up to this point, we don't know what the heck these midichlorians are. But I have a few things to say about that a little bit later on. But, you know, he's got this midichlorian count that's off the chart, you know, more than Yoda. And, you know, oh, my gosh, this kid is – we don't know what this kid is. He's incredibly powerful, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally forgot to mention that. But, yeah, that is one of the best – one of the biggest points that we get on Tatooine is the fact that, you know, this whole circumstance with Anakin points to, according to Qui-Gon, points to him being the chosen one. You know, Shmi is like, you know, I carried him. I raised him. I carried him. I gave birth to him. I raised him. I can't explain what happened, you know? And she doesn't seem to me like the type of person that, being a slave, she would have wanted to have gotten pregnant and given birth to someone that would have been born into slavery. So it had to be something, you know, that was the will of the Force that happened to her. So, but yeah, that is a very important plot point there in the film.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, let's go to the pod race. So the pod race is, I don't have much to say about it because there's really not a whole lot to say except it's awesome.
Yeah.
This is NASCAR on steroids, you know, and it's just such a cool sequence. I mean, the graphics are so well done. It looks so real. The dynamic characters involved, all these different aliens that are involved. Sebulba is just this punk, you know, that basically, you know, just he'll bully you in the safety of his pod, but otherwise he's probably just this little girl who runs off and cries. you know, I love the pod race. And not to mention how cool so many of the pods sound. I mean, Sebulba's, his pod sounds so cool. You know, I absolutely love the pod race. But I don't have a ton to say about it except that. So I'll let you say what you know.
Oh, no. It's just an amazing adrenaline rush sequence. And of course, you know, it helps that, you know, there's so much riding on it. You know, not only do they need Anakin to win so they can get the money for the parts, but now Qui-Gon has made a bet with Watto that if Anakin wins, Anakin is given his freedom.
Right.
So,
and if he loses, they lose everything. They lose their ship.
Yeah.
They lose all their hope.
Exactly. So, not only is it just cool to watch for what it is, but it's got so much writing on it. And of course, Anakin comes through in the end and wins in dramatic fashion, much to the relief of everyone and much to the expectation of Qui-Gon. So, because I'm pretty sure Qui-Gon was just like, well, it's going to have to happen because he's the chosen one. You know, he's just, Qui-Gon has this complete faith in the living Force that I don't think he ever doubted that it would happen. So, but after that, you know, Anakin is told that he's now freed. And we have that great scene where...
Oh, wait, before we get to that, because I know what you're going to say, I just have one quick point, if you don't mind, and then please jump into
that. Sure.
But yeah, it's, again, Anakin wins the race, and I love it when they're, you know, they're in the garage afterwards, and Padme gives him the hug and the kiss, and then his mother does, and she says, you know, oh, this is so wonderful, Annie, you've brought hope to those who have none. I think that's great. You know, I mean, Anakin is this, you know, this little boy who's a slave who, you know, shows that anybody can do what they really want. Anybody, you know, if there's something you're really good at, if you try really hard, it'll come out to your gain. And again, when Anakin went into the race, he didn't really look to get anything out of this. He was doing all of this for Qui-Gon and Padme, these people he barely knows. I think the only thing that he really got out of it is the thrill of pod racing. You know, there's no doubt that he certainly loves to pod race. But, you know, his selflessness is basically rewarded, though. And the very fact that he is freed. He doesn't realize Qui-Gon has bartered for him to be freed. But it's like he gave everything of his up for these people, and now he's inevitably being rewarded. You know, it's kind of like this universal message. The more you offer of yourself, you know, paradoxically, the more you get in return. And that's exactly what happens to Anakin here. He gave everything he could in this pod race, and what happens? He wins, and unbeknownst to him up until this point, he's freed now. And then Qui-Gon tells him, look, you're free now. You can come with me. And that creates a conundrum for him, which I'm going to let you bring up.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, he's all excited, but then he realizes, wait, what about Mom? You know, because he and his mom are basically all each other has up until this point. And they have a very close relationship. And, you know, Qui-Gon's, well, I tried to free her, but Watto wouldn't have it. So Anakin is put in the spot where he wants to go so bad, and his mom is so supportive of wanting a better life for her son, but he has to make this difficult decision one way or the other of either staying with his mom as a slave or leaving free and with the possibility of never seeing his mom again. And I think it's really a very wise and empowering thing of Shmi by telling Anakin, well, this path has been placed before you and the choice is yours alone. So, you know, she's not going to tell him to do one thing or the other. So, you know, she would she love to, you know, still have him around? Of course, but she really wants him to have this better life. But if he's going to have this better life, it has to be something that he wants. So she makes him make that decision. And then, of course, you know, he goes, gets his stuff, and they leave the apartment, the quarters there, and, you know, they have that very touching scene outside that's still, to this day, even this past weekend, just gives me chills every time I see it, where, you know, Anakin finally decides that he's going to leave, and he starts walking away, and music rises, and we see that last shot of Shmi standing there by herself in front of the slave hovel. And it's one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, scene of the entire film.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, yeah, I absolutely love this film, this scene as well. You know, because again, Shmi shows where Anakin gets his moral fiber from. I mean, here's this woman who willingly, you know, lets her son leave. Like, yes, she could have said, like, no, Anakin, I really want you to stay with me. But she's the ideal mother. She's the ideal parent figure, you know. This great path has been placed before Anakin, and the choice is his. It's not hers. And she recognizes this. And this is, again, the sign of a good parent. You know, she's saying, you know, this is something you've always wanted. This is a future much brighter than anything you could have here. You know, you should go if you really want to go. You know, she doesn't try to hold him back at all. She certainly doesn't push him away, but she makes it very clear. This is for you to decide, Anakin. And I mean, think about this. He's a 9-year-old boy. That's not an easy decision to make.
No.
I mean, you know, to some extent, you know, they're gonna. You know, when they, you know, the way that it worked in the Jedi Order at this point in the Star Wars universe is obviously they took babies because a baby, you know, has no idea. You can, you know, raise them in the Jedi Order so that all they know is the Jedi and that's their family. And then you look at somebody like Luke in the OT, and Luke obviously he's much more of an adult though. I mean, he is, yes, you know, Yoda says, oh, he's too old to begin the training because, you know, his mind's going to be too shaped by his experiences, but at the same time, he's at least adult enough to make this decision. Anakin at 9 years old, 9, 10 years old, this is an awkward stage, you know. He's still dependent on his mother, but at the same time, like, he knows that there's so much more for him. And, you know, he's obviously going to take that path. But like you said, you know, this is one of the most touching scenes in all of Star Wars, I think, is the scene where he is finally leaving, you know, the hovel where Shmi is out front, and they have this beautiful little dialogue between each other, and he makes it very clear, like, the only thing I'm afraid of right now is I'll never see you again. And of course, any 9-year-old boy would be afraid of never seeing his mother again. But, you know, she gives him that courage. She says, you know, have courage. This is what you're supposed to do, and you know it. Don't look back. And, you know, off he goes. And like you said, the music rises, and it's this incredible scene. You know, it's, I love it. But again, this walking away from his mother is going to plague him for the next 10 years. He wasn't fully ready for that. He never learned how to cope with that loss. And that's going to be very sad for him. But
right.
On an exciting note, immediately after, we have the awesome fight between Darth Maul and Qui-Gon in the desert. And it's literally like the perfect appetizer to the main course we'll get later in the film. You know, it's so fast. It's really zoomed in, so you don't get to see it in all its, you know, glory. And then, you know, we're on the ship, and you're like, no, get off the ship. Who cares? Yes, he's in trouble. Whatever. Get back to the fight. You know, it's just so cool. And, you know, oh, the cloaks are swirling. Oh, I absolutely love that fight. To me, it's one of the best duels in all of Star Wars. I mean, I'm certainly not nearly as good as the main course we're going to get at the end of the film, but I almost like this little fight more than almost all the other duels in the prequels. I mean, it's just awesome, I think. Anakin, drop!
Yeah.
It's down. It's going down. Like, it's so cool.
Yeah. And then I love the music for this fight, too. It's such an awesome little thing, because we've been on Tatooine for a while, and we've been with this whole side story about Anakin for quite a while. But now, as they're getting ready to leave, and Anakin is starting off on this big journey, this big new journey with Qui-Gon, we are instantly brought back to what the greater story is for this film, with Darth Maul and Qui-Gon having this duel and this confrontation. It's, you know, we've seen Qui-Gon take care of himself very well, you know, take care of battle droids with ease this entire film. And now all of a sudden he's being forced back and back and back and back by this, you know, hooded, cloaked, demon-faced Sith, you know, that has hardly said two sentences this entire film. And, you know, with a ferocious, you know, with a ferocity that we hadn't seen before in a lightsaber duel. So not only is it the first, you know, like the appetizer for what happens later on, but it's the little duel there is more, is quicker and is faster and more intense, to use a George Lucas phrase, than any of the other duels from the original trilogy, as far as skills are concerned. So, and I guess maybe that's one reason why it is such a fun little duel for so many of us.
Yeah, yeah. And then, obviously, immediately after that, we have the first meeting of Anakin and Obi-Wan. You know, Anakin, this is Obi-Wan. I would like you to meet Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're a Jedi, too? Pleased to meet you. I don't know why that was Southern, but, you know, the prequel is, I mean, it's literally what it's supposed to be. It's a prequel. It's giving us, how do these characters meet? I mean, we all want to know. Here we go. You know, how do Obi-Wan and Anakin meet? Right after this sweet duel. Like, it's so cool.
Exactly.
You know, and it's really interesting, too. I think you see this as much on screen, but I can remember reading the novel. Have you read the novel, Jason?
It's been a while.
Yeah, me as well. Years. I haven't read it in a while either. But the one thing I always remembered was how much Obi-Wan resented Anakin in the novel. He just found him to be this annoying. As he said earlier in the, you know, earlier before they leave Tatooine, why do I feel that we've picked up another pathetic life form? You know, he didn't like Jar Jar. Now he finds Anakin to be another hindrance. It's funny, you know, Obi-Wan is not in tune with the living force the way Qui-Gon is. Qui-Gon is capable of meeting new people and adapting around them, whereas Obi-Wan is, you know, much more narrow-minded. And I like that, you know, in the novel, it was very apparent when Obi-Wan first meets Anakin. In the film, it's almost like, you know, he gives him this pleasant little smile, and you're like, oh, yay, that's cute. But in the book, it's like, it's a fake smile. He's just annoyed, which I always thought was very interesting.
Yeah, I do remember that. And, you know, it's... Obi-Wan doesn't show hardly any emotion in the entire film, which makes him almost unlikable at points, until the very end, of course. Which is sort of an interesting introduction to the character. You know, Qui-Gon, you know, is, you know, he's just so open to so many things that Obi-Wan almost... I probably feels like he has to compensate for that by, you know, no, that's not what the rules say. This is the way the book says, you know, this is the code. You know, what are you doing? You know, he's so straight-laced because Qui-Gon is so open and free flowing, and you know, and just willing to change directions based on the will of the Force. But Obi-Wan almost comes off as unlikable at points, which is kind of funny, because you know he definitely changes a lot in the next 10 years for the next film. But unless you have anything you want to talk about on these other scenes, I'm just going to skip to Coruscant. Unless you want to.
No, that's where I'm going to go next too.
Okay. So we finally, after all this, you know, engine trouble, we make it to Coruscant, and Queen Amidala goes in and meets Senator Palpatine, and you know, he immediately starts telling her, well, this is the way things really are, you know, and Chancellor Valorum is very weak, and he's mired by baseless accusations of corruption. The bureaucrats are in charge now, and, you know, gives her two options. Basically, he says, we could either submit a plea to the courts, which takes forever, or we could, you know, oust the chancellor. You know, he's like, if we want to get anything done, those are basically our choices. And she's like, it's not something I can do, because he's the one that got us here. He's the one that sent us the negotiators, you know, the Jedi, you know, but we see Palpatine at work already. You know, it makes perfect sense from a politician's point of view, you know, but he's really doing some very devious maneuvering there. So, I don't know if you want to say anything about that before we hit the Jedi Council, but...
No, and again, not too much. We see him as this, you know, he's kind of the sly politician. But basically what he's going to do here is he's going to put a bug in Amidala's ear to call for a vote of no confidence in Valorum. You know, he makes it very clear, you know, the political system right now is basically being run by... you know, greedy politicians, and Valorum's under their whim. The only way to fix this is to get rid of him. So he kind of plants that bug in her ear. He's all about, you know, planting seeds of doubt. He's very good at this. We'll see him do this, obviously, a lot more in Episode 2 and even more in Episode 3 with Anakin. But, you know, that's what he's doing to the Queen here, is he wants to put the seed of doubt. But then we were whisked off to the Jedi Council, and I love the Jedi Temple. I mean, it's such a cool looking building to begin with. These four tall spires, and then we're up in the High Council chamber, and it's just so cool. I mean, it's such a simple room yet so beautiful. I mean, it looks out over this huge city, but it's this nexus of the Force, and you see how it's run. You know, you have this order of Jedi that is very well structured. It's very well run. You know, you have this High Council. You have, you know, these men and women who are in charge and who are kind of running things. It's its own political system in a way. I mean, it has its own hierarchy, and you know, they work with the you know, the Republic, and it's kind of like, you know, back in the Middle Ages, you know, if you will, you know, when you had European government and the church working together. You know, it was this spiritual force and this political force all working together. That's kind of what's happening with, you know, the Jedi or the spiritual force working with the government. And it's very well structured. But in this conversation, you know, basically, you know, Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan are reporting in on what's been going on. And he's obviously just told to them about his fight with Darth Maul. And he makes it pretty clear. It looks like the Sith are back. And you know, Mace Windu, who's ever as arrogant as possible, I do not believe the Sith could have returned without us knowing. But then Yoda, of course, always the wise one. Difficult to see the dark side is.
Hard to see the dark side is.
Yeah, and it's so true, you know, but here's this new issue they have to deal with. Oh, crap, the Sith might be back. And then, you know, they're like, okay, great, thank you. Thanks for bringing this before us. We're going to figure out what's going on. We'll find out who this attacker was. And Obi-Wan turns to leave, but Qui-Gon's still standing there, confident as ever, you know?
More to say. More to say, have you?
Yeah, and, you know, he goes off and tells him about this vergence in the Force, and he's basically found somebody who might possibly have been conceived by the midichlorians. And, you know, then Mace Windu introduces us to this idea of a Jedi prophecy about a chosen one who will bring balance to the Force. Now, what exactly does the balance of the Force mean? That's something I'd love to talk about in a different topic, or a different show. I won't get into that now. But, you know, it's, you know, Qui-Gon has made it very apparent now to the Council. Like, he counters, you know, the bad news. You know, he gives them the bad news first. Crud, the Sith might be back. Good news, I think I found the chosen one. And, of course, the Council, you know, is very silent. You know, it's... to a certain degree, which is respectable, you know, they're a council of wise beings who aren't going to just be like, get all excited about it and all worked up and get all anxious. They're like, okay, well, we're going to think about this, you know, bring the boy before us. We'll go from there, you know, one step at a time. So that's enough,
right.
Enough rambling for me about that scene, but I'll let you chip in here.
I love the Jedi Council scenes too, but yeah, this is—it's really, you know, we're introduced to them, and obviously we know Yoda from the original trilogy, so we're always very excited to see him. But seeing him among all of his peers and seeing how stoic and somber-faced they are, and of course Sam Jackson thrown in there for, you know, a little bit of arrogant attitude, slightly, you know, just. To give the Jedi Council just a slight indifferent edge to them, you know, indifferent, slight, you know, almost, you know, rolls their eyes. This whole, you know, we've heard this before. We've heard, you know, the Chosen One has supposedly been found before. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that whole experience has happened, but, you know, or maybe it's just rolling their eyes at dealing with Qui-Gon and his, you know, living Force ideas that keep popping up. But they, while I love the council scenes, they do almost give up this, you know, well, I guess just bring him before us. We'll see if, you know, you're right on this one, Qui-Gon. Attitude, you know, at least, especially Mace Windu gives that sort of impression, in my opinion, which is kind of funny. Mace Windu is such an interesting character. He's obviously very wise and very skilled with the lightsaber, but he is a bit arrogant and kind of snotty sometimes. You know, as Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan go get Anakin, you know, we're introduced to the Galactic Senate, with Queen Amidala and Palpatine trying to plead their case, and get help for Naboo. And of course, we're introduced to the fact that, you know, it's not just planets that have senators, the Trade Federation has senators, you know, and they obviously don't want anything happening with the situation, so they're gonna try and stonewall, which immediately gets seconded by the Congress of Malastare concurs with the honorable delegates of the Trade Federation. A commission must be appointed. And of course, Valorum is forced to acquiesce, and Queen Amidala is just like, I can't believe I came all this way for nothing. And so she's like, she acts on the seeds of doubt that Palpatine planted in her and, you know, moves for a vote of no confidence in Chancellor Valorum, which probably was a little shocking and a bit of a betrayal from his point of view, because, you know, he worked hard to bring her here and to get her help that he could send her, but now that things aren't getting done, she's like, okay, bye.
Yeah, next, please. Yeah. Right. But, you know, at the same time, that's, it shows, you know, her lack of confidence now. She sees, though, to a certain degree, what Palpatine warned her about. You know, he makes it very clear that this political system, this political body isn't working. We need somebody new. And I love it, you know, she says, you know, we need to send this commission. And as soon it seems like Valorum is on her side. He's quick to respond, like, okay, yeah, we need to take more quicker action. And as soon as he's about to kind of speak up in her defense, you know, Massimetta grabs him and whispers something to him. And Palpatine's like, look, he's being swindled right now by those with the money, those with the power. Don't expect him to get your back. And he was right. So, you know, Palpatine's a very cunning politician. He knows what's going on. So, you know, that's a good scene. And then, you know, we go back to the council. Are you cool with me going back to the council for Anakin?
Yeah. No, it's a very good back and forth they have here, these two storylines in the film. On the one hand with all the Senate, and then on the other hand with the Jedi Council. And so it fits perfectly to go back and forth.
Right.
So.
Right. And so then we get back to the council where they're testing Anakin. And, you know, they're basically just, I mean, it's a very simple test. And Anakin's, he got 100 based on what we see, you know. I mean, every image that pops up on the view screen Mace Windu's holding, Anakin gets right. But then they start probing into him, you know. Yoda asks him how he feels, you know, I'm cold. And again, you know, some people could easily interpret that as like, oh, he's such a cold-hearted person. No, he's cold because, again, like on the ship ride to Coruscant, he's not used to being in anywhere but Tatooine, which is a very hot planet. And, you know, they start peeking through him, and Ki-Adi-Mundi calls him out, you know, is your thoughts dwell on your mother? Well, I miss her. No, duh. I just said goodbye to her. And Yoda, you know, gives us this great quote on fear, and fear's the path to the dark side. And, you know, it's very clear to the council that what has them so nervous above everything else is this deep-seated fear now in Anakin over the loss of his mother. You know, saying goodbye to her wasn't easy at all, and this is going to eat away at him. And that's the fear of the Jedi Council.
It's ironic that, you know, they're, you know, it's Anakin's fear, you know, what has that got to do with it? Well, fear is a path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering, you know. But yet at the same time, the Jedi Council are afraid. They're afraid of what might happen if they do accept him.
Right.
So it's almost ironic there. Not almost. It is ironic.
It is, yes.
Because, you know, they're pointing out his fear, and yet they're afraid of what might happen. So, and of course, we go straight from there back over to Palpatine's apartment where Padme is, and she has this conversation with Jar Jar about, you know, the people back on Naboo and the Gungan army before Palpatine sweeps in with all his glowing surprise about being nominated to succeed Valorum as Supreme Chancellor. You know, a surprise to be sure, but a welcome one. Yeah, right, Palpatine.
yeah. He wasn't surprised.
And he, no, not at all. And then, of course, his whole plan and idea of how things are supposed to happen sort of takes a sideways turn when Queen Amidala says, I'm going back to Naboo. This is moving too slow. Our people are suffering and dying. I'm going to go help them. We're going to take care of things. Have fun. So, that just sort of leaves Palpatine dumbfounded, standing there in the middle of his living room, you know.
yeah, and it's the first time we see Palpatine / Sidious, you know, not have the upper hand. He did not see this coming. And, you know, now he's going to have to change his plans. He obviously, you know, this was not part of his plan, but now he's got to switch and adapt. This is the first time we see him not necessarily in control.
And it's also the first time that we really see Padme acting on her own accord,
yeah.
Acting on her own wishes and own thought processes. She's not been advised about this at all by anybody else. She's in everything else, she's had somebody advising her or suggesting things to her. But no, this time she's deciding, no, I've had enough. This is ridiculous. I'm doing this now because this is what is right. So
yeah, it's,
she's yeah, sorry, go ahead.
And it's funny too that this thought of hers comes in light of her conversation with Jar Jar. You know, he says, you know, the gun's gonna get pasted too. She says, I hope not. And you know, and then he says, you know, well, the Gungans won't give up without a fight. We have a great army. And you know, he makes it apparent that this is probably some of the conflict then between the Naboo and the Gungans, is that Naboo are obviously very hardcore pacifists. But I think this lights a little fire in Padme though, where she thinks like, I have a plan now. I know what I need to do. I need to go back. I need to unite our planet. And we need to overthrow the Trade Federation. So, you know, like you said, though, this is the first time she's the one who's going to take the reins. But it's funny that it's basically, I wonder if it's quite a bit piqued, though, by Jar Jar. I mean, she's obviously, it's clear, this isn't going to go fast enough. If I go through these political channels, my people are all going to be dead. But now she actually has, you know, some idea as to what she might actually be able to do. She can enlist the help of the Gungans.
Right. Right. Which is... it's kind of interesting how Jar Jar just keeps popping up, but just, oh, an innocent comment of, you know, yeah, we're different. Yeah, this is, but maybe that's why you don't like us. Maybe it's because we have this army that you guys don't like us. You know, just sort of his own thought process is being spoken out loud and an innocent comment. And she's like, aha, you know, yeah. So it's, she sweeps out of the room and gives a parting comment, you know, I pray you'll bring sanity and compassion back to the Senate, you know. And we're swept right back over to the Council.
Right.
And Anakin is not going to be trained. You know, he will be trained then? No. No, he will not be trained. You know, Mace Windu is just like, no, we don't want him. You know?
Yeah.
It's almost... you know, it, of course, sets off a wonderful relationship between Anakin and Mace Windu. but, you know, Qui-Gon still jumps to his defense, and he's like, no, he is the Chosen One, you know, and almost, and just basically defies the Council again by saying, I'm going to train him. But, an apprentice, you have Qui-Gon. Impossible to take on a second. The code forbids it. You know, and Qui-Gon's like, well, Obi-Wan's...
sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. No, go ahead. No, the code forbids it. You know, he's just like... Mace is like, you can't get away with this one, Qui-Gon. You know, you can't get away this time, Qui-Gon. You know, we're not going to let you slip that one in. But Qui-Gon has a rebuttal. Well, Obi-Wan's ready. You know, and Obi-Wan may be out of, you know... irritation with his master, or you know, pleased that his master thinks so highly of him, is like, I am ready to face the trials. So, you know, but we learned that, you know, the Council doesn't want to deal with it right now because Queen Amidala is returning home. So they've just been given word, so they have to send Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan back with her. And Anakin has to tag along with them because his fate, Yoda says that his fate will be decided later. So first they say no, then they say, well, his fate will be decided later, you know, after Qui-Gon jumps in with this, outrageous statement there, totally against protocol. Gosh, Qui-Gon.
yeah.
But gosh, Qui-Gon doesn't do anything by the rules. How rude.
right.
But that's why we love him.
Yes.
And so go ahead.
Yeah, well, I love the scene as well. I think it's great, you know, and again, it shows the callousness of Mace Windu. You know, nope, he's not going to be trained. Gosh, Mace Windu, I really can't stand you. You know, he's so arrogant. And Qui-Gon's like, fine, I'm going to train him then. And I just love this. Like, Qui-Gon isn't somebody who's going to be pushed around by the Council. I mean, we didn't mention this earlier, but obviously there's that nice little scene while, you know, Anakin is up in the chamber being tested, that little dialogue between Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan makes it apparent, you would be on that council if you would just play by the rules. Qui-Gon basically, this is why I love Qui-Gon. It's not so much that he's a rebel or a rogue. I mean, if he was a rebel, he wouldn't be part of the Jedi Order. I mean, that's the difference between him and his master, Count Dooku. But
right.
Essentially, you know, he's not going to just be a lackey of the Order. You know, he listens to the living force. He listens to his instincts and the constant will of the force, which is ever changing. And he says, look it, you guys are wrong about this. You think you know what you're doing. I'm telling you, you're not, because I'm more in tune with the force. And I don't think he's arrogantly saying that. I don't think that's what he's trying to push forward, but that's the truth. He's like, fine, you say no, I say yes, I'm going to train him. And I think it's a well shot scene as well. And when he says that, he steps forward. But it's funny, it doesn't zoom out so you see Qui-Gon's whole body come put his hands on Anakin. Notice how it focuses in on Obi-Wan. If you catch a glimpse of Obi-Wan's reaction, he's kind of pissed. And understandably, I mean, he probably feels slighted. I mean, he's been Qui-Gon's apprentice now for, you know, probably a good 10 years. And here he is just being brushed aside. And, you know, then Qui-Gon speaks up for him, you know, when he's told he can't do this because he's already got an apprentice. He says, well, look, Obi-Wan's ready. It's basically like, I don't think Qui-Gon is rudely trying to push him aside, but he's just saying, fine, if the rule forbids me from doing what I know to be right, then I'm telling you right now, test Obi-Wan, he's fine, and I'll take Anakin. And, you know, this probably hurts for Obi-Wan, you know. Here's his master, his mentor, saying, nope, he's done, I'm done training him. I mean, that's got to hurt for Obi-Wan. And again, this is going to increase his, you know, his indignant feelings towards Anakin. And rightfully so. I mean, it can't fault Anakin. I mean, he's harmless in all of this. But, you know, Qui-Gon is, you know, as much as he's doing what is right, sometimes he's not taking into account how his own apprentice might feel about this. But I do, overall, though, I mean, I just love this because, again, it's Qui-Gon standing up for what he thinks is the will of the Force. I absolutely love this. I mean, especially for me right now as somebody who does theology, you know, the church is always saying things that I don't agree with. I don't leave the church, but it's constantly saying ridiculous things. And you have wise people like Qui-Gon who try to stand up to it. And the church is always like, no, we got to play by the rules. We got to play by the rules. And it's like, but, you know, the rules need to change sometimes. And I think that's what Qui-Gon is. He's a voice of change. He's a voice of constant challenge of, no, the force is constantly moving. We must be moving with it and stop trying to settle down all these little rules. So I think that's why I love that scene. I just went way too long. Sorry.
Nah, no worries, no worries. But, you know, it's after that, we go right into the departure where Obi-Wan is still indignant towards Qui-Gon. He's like, the boy is dangerous. They all sense it. Why can't you, you know? And Qui-Gon just sort of steps back into that master role and says, you know, his fate is undetermined, and now that'll be enough of you. Now get on board. You know, he just sort of goes right into that master role and, you know, says, I don't want to hear about this because I know that he's the chosen one and I'm not going to take any crap. If I'm not going to take crap from the council, I'm not going to take crap from you. So, and then, of course, we get into the whole dialogue about midichlorians, which we picked apart a bit last episode. So I won't go into it. If you want to talk about that, go ahead.
I'll just make a quick point. And the only reason I'm bringing it up is because I've been reading the Darth Plagueis novel right now by James Luceno, which is very good, by the way. Actually, it's not very good. It's good. It's a little too heady for me for a Star Wars novel, but that's a separate issue. But he does do a lot of exploration into the midichlorians, and it's given me a little bit more respect for the midichlorians. And essentially what the midichlorians are is it's not necessarily a cop-out of the mystery of the Force, because the midichlorians are not the Force. They are essentially like this organism inside of us that make it us capable of hearing the Force. And actually the reason I like this is when I did some studies in undergrad about these, like, God genes, is what they're called, that some people have these, literally, they have genes inside their bodies that make them more susceptible to spiritual realities. I actually just watched a program on this on Netflix, too, a few nights ago, about literally there's certain chemicals and genes within human beings that make them more susceptible to, you know, spiritual realities, whatever you want to call them. So I thought the midichlorians are an interesting way of introducing the fact that they themselves do not, they are not the Force, all right? The midichlorians do not make up the Force. So it doesn't necessarily take away from the mystery. It's basically saying that there is literally something inside people that make them capable of communicating with the Force. And it just seems like Jedi have more midichlorians than other people because they're more susceptible to the Force. So I somewhat understand the midichlorians a little bit better now, and I think that they do make sense. Still not, you know, I don't love them, but I think that's what they're trying to do. Is it's kind of this, they're a medium, they're a physical medium that mediates the Force with human beings, but they themselves are not the Force. So
that does make more sense.
Yeah. So anywho, but yeah, so that's basically the landing platform scene. We get the midichlorians. Obi-Wan gets put in his place again, and Jar Jar is very happy to go home.
Yes, I'm going home!
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's why I opened it. But, But then, yeah.
And,
go ahead.
We get this little scene back on Naboo with the Trade Federation talking with, you know, with Gunray and Rune Hakko talking with Sidious again in a very nicely filmed scene. I like how dark that scene is and the way that it's filmed. When, you know, they're reporting that, you know, we have taken over all the last pockets of primitive life forms. We are in complete control of the planet now. And then we are told by Sidious, you know, good, I'm sending my apprentice, Darth Maul, to join you. And of course, the first thing that pops into, you know, Rune Hakko's mind is, a Sith here? You know, he's like, oh my god, that's not good. You know, so, you know, which is our response, you know, oh my gosh, that's not good for our heroes. But, so now we know not only are our heroes heading back to Naboo, but so is Darth Maul. So we're going to have this confrontation that everybody is looking forward to.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and The only other scene I want to mention before we get to the closing battle is just, you know, the small scene where basically the Queen goes to confront Boss Nass to enlist the help of the Gungans. The thing I like about this scene is basically you see, you know, so you have the decoy come forward, which again, really none of us knew but that this was a decoy either. She's talking to Boss Nass in this monotone, boring voice, although Padme pretty much has a monotone, boring voice the entire PT, but... you know, she's like, oh, you know, you should join us. We should fight together. But then Padme's like, this is not going to work. It's time to be honest. It's time to be real with these people. You know, so she steps forward and says, I'm the queen. She reveals who she really is. And she humbles herself. She humbles her people. She says, we're not better than you. And she bows down and says, we beg you to help us. She makes it very apparent. You know, Boss Nass's concern earlier in the film was, you know, that the Naboo think they're better than us. Here she is making it very apparent. We need you. We are no better than you. We need you to save this planet. And that's what, you know, that's what basically converts and changes Boss Nass's heart, and it changes his mind. He's like, yes, okay, I get it now. You are humble people. You do need our help, and good, we're going to give it to you. So I like that scene.
Yeah, she puts them on, by humbling herself, she puts them all on equal ground. And I love the responses of everyone when we find out, you know, I am Queen Amidala. You know, I remember sitting in the theater going, what? And of course, you know, Jar Jar standing right next to her, huh? And, you know, Anakin's confused look. And of course, Boss Nass is a little shocked, and we hear all the Gungans muttering, blah, 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 you know, that. And then, of course, later on, as she continues talking, just that little look between Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan. I just love that reaction. You know, they're like, why didn't we know that? Why didn't we pick up on that? You know? That's one of the best reaction shots, I think, in the entire saga. It's just, I am Queen Amidala, and we just get this little shot, and they're just like, boy, we were fooled, you know, which is, you know, sort of this wry thing, you know, well, even Jedi aren't all-seeing and aren't all-powerful, you know.
Right.
Even they can be fooled by a decoy. So.
Yeah.
But yes, and of course we. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to just get into the closing battle.
Yeah, we get into the closing battle, which I love the way everything. I love the way that they drop the pin. They hit the starting gate, you know. Wipe them out. All of them. You know, Sidious's most ominous line in the entire prequel trilogy, almost, before he reveals himself. I just love that line. And then we get the plane battle, the planes battles, the Gungans and the battle droids, and then we have this other battle being set up where the Naboo and the Jedi are sneaking in to the city to take back the palace, and they're going to send the pilots to launch out into space to take out the droid control ship. And it just, all mayhem starts breaking loose. And it, in typical great Star Wars fashion, and just lasers flying everywhere, explosions, battle droids, you know, clanking and falling, and, you know, R2 is, you know, whirling around in the middle of that, getting up into his ship, obviously, you know. R2's always in the middle of everything, you know, sooner or later.
Which you love.
But I do. That's what makes him awesome. But I just love the way everything is set up, and not to mention the Gungan shield generator, I thought was just really cool, you know, which was nice to see how they were able to, you know, keep the tanks and stuff at bay so they didn't just get decimated from the beginning. But I just liked how everything was set up, and not to mention, like I mentioned, one of our other shows, our top five ships, is I love the Naboo Starfighter. I think it's just a cool looking ship. So getting to see those in action, get that all started up again, was just fun for me. And I'm looking forward for the next month or so to seeing the new Naboo Starfighter action figure ship come out in stores and picking that up. So I just love the end battle sequences of all the Star Wars films. Nobody pulls off a battle sequence the way George Lucas does, because he has so many different events happening at the same time.
Right. Yeah, and it's a great closing battle, and the thing I like about it too so much is we have so many different fronts, which is cool. You know, I mean, it's similar to Return of the Jedi. You know, we have a land battle going on. We've got, you know, the space battle going on. But, you know, to me, what makes this, to me, the greatest moment in The Phantom Menace is, of course, the duel. And we've got the greatest duel in the history of Star Wars, in my opinion, is between Darth Maul, Qui-Gon, and Obi-Wan. I mean, it's just awesome. That scene where he shows up, you know, we'll handle this. Well, we'll take the long way. it's so great. And we have so much going on. You know, we see, you know, I agree with you, the land battle, the shield generators the Gungans have is so cool. It's a really cool battle with the battle droids. You know, we've got, you know, this little adventure with the Queen and Panaka getting to Newt Gunray and stuff. But to me, that stuff all just the space battle's okay. I'm not in love with the space battle, and they're not over committing to that anyway. It's good, but it's not certainly amazing. But to me, all of that stuff pales in comparison to the duel. I can remember the first time I saw that film in theaters when I was 14. You know, when the duel started, literally, like, my heart was thumping so fast. I had goosebumps. I was, like, on the edge of my seat. I mean, I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Not to mention the Duel of the Fates music in the background. Like, I mean, unbelievable. That duel is just so cool. And so I'm not going to say too much about the battles because we've been talking for a while, so I don't want to keep going. And there's not too much to say. I mean, they're all really cool battles, but I think my favorite part, and then I'll be done with talking about the closing action, is, you know, basically right after Qui-Gon gets killed, which I hated. I literally think I might have screamed no with Obi-Wan in the theater when I was 14. Because, I mean, I knew, obviously, we all knew Qui-Gon was going to have to die, but you just didn't expect it that soon. And you're just heartbroken because I loved this character. And then Obi-Wan, like, just the way he's glaring at Darth Maul. And, you know, they're both, like, the way they both are just kind of, like, pulsating. They can't even stand still waiting for that shield wall to open. And they just go at it, like, that short sequence, just the two of them, is so fast. I think I probably wore out my VHS tape rewinding that and slowing it down and rewinding it and slowing it down and trying to do that fight with my friends. Like, it was amazing how well done that was. So.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they, while the other battles are fun, and then the space battle, we get to see, you know, Anakin's piloting skills even as a, you know, 9-year-old kid. It just, the biggest moment, the most important moment, and the most focused on moment, as it rightly should be, is the duel between Qui-Gon, Obi-Wan, and Darth Maul. Because this is the Jedi meeting up with the Sith for the first time in 1,000 years. Not only is it just an awesome-looking duel with great characters, but it is the first time that the Jedi and the Sith are facing off again after 1,000 years. And it is epic, as it should be. Darth Maul, the devil, you know, with his double-bladed lightsaber, ridiculously awesome saber, I might add. But it was just such a great duel, the way that they, not only the way that it was choreographed, but just the way they filmed it and the whole journey it took them deeper and deeper into this energy plant, this power plant, whatever it was. When Darth Maul stabbed Qui-Gon through the heart, the gut, that whole area, that was shocking. I mean, we knew going in Qui-Gon was going to die. I mean, I knew going in because my dad was reading us, like, the film review in the theater, you know, in the paper right before we went to go see the movie. And, you know, the interviewer had been, you know, mentioned a quote that Qui-Gon, that Liam Neeson had about Qui-Gon dying, and so I was like, oh, that's sad. Well, I hope he does good. But so I knew he was going to die, but even just the way that it happened, it was just so sudden and so shocking that, you know, Obi-Wan's yelling just sort of reverberated through my head and my soul, just like, no! You know, it was not the way it was supposed to happen. I just was like, no, he's too good of a character. But, you know, it did up the ante as far as Darth Maul is concerned. But it was just the way it happened. It was, even though going in you knew it was going to happen, the way it happened just still shocked you to some degree.
And it's the most...
And then, of course...
It's also kind of one of the most brutal death scenes in all of Star Wars. I mean, we literally see him pulling the lightsaber out of Qui-Gon. You know, I mean, he got impaled. It's very, very, you know, very gruesome for a Star Wars scene.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but the whole duel between Obi-Wan and Darth Maul after that is just so intense and so fast. And this is the most emotion that we've seen out of Obi-Wan. I mean, Obi-Wan has had this up and down interaction with his master the entire movie. But he still really deeply cares about his master. And so that just sets Obi-Wan off. And just when Darth Maul tosses him into the generator shaft, you know, that whole feral look that he gets just stalking above Obi-Wan when he tosses his lightsaber down the shaft is just almost chilling. And then, of course, Obi-Wan gets the upper hand and cuts Darth Maul in half, and but apparently he survives. So, which we will see in the Clone Wars next month. I'm looking forward to that. But that is neither here nor there. But at the end of it all, Qui-Gon, his dying request is that Obi-Wan train Anakin. At the end of the entire battle, Qui-Gon, a very sad scene of Qui-Gon's death, he asks Obi-Wan to train Anakin. So, I feel like I've talked a lot, so you go ahead.
Absolutely, you know, and that's so important, too. And again, to a certain degree, I always felt bad for Obi-Wan there, because it's like, you know, say something nice to him, like you've been his master for years now. But he doesn't. All he says is, you know, I want you to train Anakin. And again, it's just Qui-Gon has put all this faith in the fact that Anakin is the chosen one. He's the one who will bring balance to the Force. I mean, it is nice. He does, like, reach his hand up to, you know, dry the tears that are about to come down Obi-Wan's face, which I think that is, he doesn't necessarily have to say anything. That little action does say, you know, I care about you, Obi-Wan, but don't cry for me. Things will be okay. And, you know, he basically lets Obi-Wan in, though, and Obi-Wan's going to continue his legacy by training Anakin. And I'm just going to make some last final comments to wrap up the movie here. You know, so then basically the movie, you know, quickly comes to an end. We get our conclusion, you know, Newt Gunray and Roon Hako are shipped off. Palpatine is now the Supreme Chancellor. We have the funeral scene for Qui-Gon. And Obi-Wan and, or excuse me, Yoda and Mace Windu talk about, you know, the fact that there's always two Sith, so who was destroyed? And then it zooms in on Palpatine's face, and it's very apparent the Master's still around. But also, you know, before that scene, though, too, is, you know, the Council, who seemed to be so reluctant earlier in the film to letting Anakin be trained, has now granted Obi-Wan, this newly granted Jedi Knight, to train the Chosen One, which I always, you know, again, I find this to be a little silly. Like, they're so reluctant to train him, and then they give it to a new Jedi Knight. Like, that's a big task for Obi-Wan. You know, it seems a little bit foolish of the Council to give him such a huge task right away. But at the same time, he is very, very clear. I'm going to train him, whether you guys like it or not. That was my promise to Qui-Gon. So I like the fact that he has some of Qui-Gon's defiance. And then, of course, the last scene of the film, to me, it mirrors perfectly the ending from A New Hope. You know, you have this victory celebration. Everybody's standing up there on a stage. Yay, we won. The end. And for me, the end for me for tonight.
Yeah. No, it does wrap up very nicely, yet still has some lingering threads to continue on the story, especially with the whole Sith aspect. And Obi-Wan taking Anakin on. But it does wrap up very nicely, and I love the end parade with the Gungans and the Naboo, and the music there. It's just a fun celebration. It gives you this uplifting moment to propel you into the next film. And it wraps up very nicely, and we've been talking a long time, so I will wrap up my discussion on The Phantom Menace there. So,
no, and I agree with you, though, real quick. You know, that is a fun music at the end. And I remember after I'd seen it I'd probably seen it like 3 or 4 times in the theaters, then I started hearing about how, you know, you hear Darth Vader breathing at the end of the credits. And I was like, oh, my God, I have to go see this again just for that so I can stay till the end of the credits. Which is, like, ridiculous. But...
Right.
But, yeah. So, there you have it. That was our brief discussion of The Phantom Menace. Brief in 2.5 hours. So, hopefully we haven't lost people's interest. But I've had a great time. And I could have talked even more. Isn't that crazy? I mean, we can talk longer than the movie itself.
That just shows how great these movies are.
Exactly. So, but before we go, just two pieces of information. Actually, three, because we almost forgot this last time. For those of you who want to contact us, please know that we definitely encourage you, if you haven't done this already, to either follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. We'd love to get more people involved. So you can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/wampaslair. Or you can find us on Facebook at Wampa's Lair Podcast. You can email us at wampaslairpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can, of course, find us on our website at starwarsreport.com. We'd love to hear more from you, and especially hear from you about our next lightsaber matchup, which we will be pitting Master Obi-Wan Kenobi versus Jedi Master Yoda. That should be interesting. So,
interesting this should be.
So please, you know, let us know, shoot us an email, write on our Facebook wall, give us a tweet, tell us who you think would win between Obi-Wan and Yoda, and you know, we'll discuss that on the next show. And the last thing we'd like to do, of course, the last two shows I've hinted at our first Star Wars giveaway. So again, this, what we're going to be giving away is a 12-inch General Grievous Revenge of the Sith line. I'm not sure if it's an action figure or a doll. I don't know what to describe it as, but it's a 12-inch Revenge of the Sith line General Grievous. I will be posting an image of this to Facebook tomorrow. Jason is going to read you the question. And the rules are pretty simple. The first person to answer the question correctly, you can either write on our Facebook wall or send us an email, and we'll obviously just based on, you know, time and date, the first person to get this question right. However, nobody is allowed to enter until this Saturday, which that date would be the 18th. So on February 18th, please write in as quickly as you can if you know the answer to our question. And the first person to get it right will win the 12-inch General Grievous. So, Jason, if you would be so kind as to read the question for our listeners.
Yes. The question that we have is Phantom Menace related, because of this podcast. So, the question is, what three roles did Warwick Davis play in the Phantom Menace? Obviously, we know Warwick Davis as Wicket from Return of the Jedi, but he played three minor roles in the Phantom Menace. What are they? And please remember on Saturday the 18th, send in your answers. You can obviously do it, like we said, on Facebook or email. Email would be probably easiest because that way our email address is connected to my phone. So I will be able to see who sends in the answer first. Easiest that way. So, once again, what three roles did Warwick Davis play in The Phantom Menace? And is there anything else that you want to say before we wrap this up, Carl?
No, that's it. It's been a lot of fun talking The Phantom Menace. I feel like I've been wrapped up in the world of 1999 again. I love it. I miss it. So if you have not seen The Phantom Menace in 3D, we recommend that you do it. You know, shoot us a message, you know, on Twitter, Facebook, email, whatever. Give us your thoughts on it. I'm always curious to talk to people about Star Wars. But for me, that's it. Jason, if you'd be so kind as to sign us off.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, once again for listening to episode 10 of the Wampa's Lair podcast, Jar Jar Strikes Back. thank you for listening to us. For Carl, I am Jason, and we will see you next time in the Wampa's Lair.
At last we will reveal ourselves to the Jedi. At last we will have revenge.
Forever. Communications disruption can mean only one thing. Invasion.
We will not condone a course of action that will lead us to war.
There is something else behind all this, Your Highness. They will kill you if you stay.
You refer to the prophecy of the one who will bring balance to the Force. You believe it's this boy?
He can see things before they happen.
Are you sure about this? Trusting our fate to a boy we hardly know?
He can help you.
The Force is unusually strong with him.
He was meant to help you.
People are dying, Senator. We must do something quickly.
Anakin!
Fear is my ally.
And I can only protect you. I can't fight a war for you.
This is a battle I do not think that we can win.
I will sign no treaty, Senator.
Much fear in you.
Will I ever see you again?
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.